Well, welcome. Good to see everybody. If it's your first time here, it's my first time lecturing, so it's going to be our first time together. So good to see you. So we're going to be talking about Christianity, the white man's religion. All right, has anyone ever thought about this topic before? Let me see a show of hands. If your hand isn't up, don't be ashamed. Shame on you. But so we're going to have an honesty moment right before we start. We're going to have an honesty moment. And the reason for the honesty moment is because sometimes when you have race conversations, they can get a little bit tense. So I just want to ease the tension in the room, if there's any. All right, so when you read the title, and maybe you didn't know what it was coming here, so, well, you know, you don't have to answer the question, right? But when you read the title, Christianity, the White Man's Religion, and you read the name next to it, right? So if you didn't know who that was, what's the image in your mind that you thought that person was going to look like? Right, so let's just think about it for a second. You read the title, so the title's here, Christianity, the White Man's Religion. What did you think the person giving the lecture would look like? What did you think? Anyone? Go ahead.
I thought he would look like Mr. Keyes.
That's okay, okay. Anyone else? Anyone else? What did you think he would? What did you think he or she would look like? Yeah, he could have been a woman as well.
I thought not really based on the title, but based on your name.
Yeah.
That you would be black.
Okay.
Okay. Like a name with possible African.
You're on it. You're on it.
I thought of an angry black man.
Okay. You know what? Thank you. Because what I was trying to, I couldn't get it done in time, but I was trying to, you know, get a Photoshop of a African American with a fro and a pick and their hand like this. And then have a Photoshop my face and start the lecture that way to say, if that's what you thought that this person was going to look like, shame on you. Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say, though, but that picture wouldn't necessitate in my mind that you would be angry.
Okay, fair,
you
fair.
Have to have a big
fair,
eye
fair.
In your hand.
fair, awesome, man. Okay, go ahead.
Are you going to ask the same question about the title? You're asking about your name. How about the title?
Okay. Okay.
No,
okay.
Yeah.
Fair. Okay. How did you react to the title when you read it?
What in the world is he going to talk about?
Okay. All right. I posted this on Facebook. And, you know, you all, like, I got interesting responses as well. You know, it's like I asked people to, like, okay, leave a comment or a question. And then, you know, I got a lot of people, like, they were, like, I guess, defending, like, oh man, Christianity, yeah, it's done that, but I mean, that's not the, you know, the way the faith is supposed to be, and like kind of giving me like long, they were lecturing me about the lecture, which was interesting as well, right? But thank you for coming. Hopefully, I say something worthwhile, all right? So, the outline we're going to talk about the problem, Christianity's universal vision, the Christian explosion, and we're going to end with some ideas on racial reconciliation. All right, so I'm going to show you some pictures and I guess explain how I got thinking about this topic. So race is a big issue all over the world, and I think one of the hardest things to actually live out is what the Americans would say is self-evident, that we're all created equal. You know, we all have inalienable rights, right? It sounds great, but I think it's one of the hardest things to live out. And from the history of humanity, we've been fighting with each other, killing each other, hating each other, and actually not treating each other as if we're equals, right? So it's not a new problem, but I was with a lot of the new, not new, but with the racial tension that is, I guess, there's a light being shined on it in our culture right now because of police brutality and so many things. A lot of my friends on social media have been posting a lot of images. And so as I was just scrolling through them, I started thinking to myself, how would I respond to some of these images? I don't know if you can see this, but it says the first slave ship used to enslave Africans was named Jesus. There's a title of a book, How to Make a Negro a Christian. And then ask yourself this, if your slave master wasn't Christian, would you be a Christian? So I was looking at, you know, some of these images, and it got me thinking about the topic and thinking about how would I respond and what would I say about Christianity. Is it for me? Right? I think because, one, if you can't see me, I am African-American, and then I think I come at it from two directions because my family is from Nigeria, so I'm actually a first-generation Nigerian-American. So it's, you know, you got the African perspective of colonialism, and then, you know, you come to America, and then you have the perspective of slavery. So it's coming from both angles of, you know, why or what are you doing in this way of thinking. All right, so I got a couple questions for us to think about as we go forward. How do you make sense of the history of the Christian movement, right? As I started thinking about it, you know, some of the things that are usually said about Christianity is, you know, the way that it was spread, specifically the way that it was spread to Africans or African Americans, it's how do you make sense of this, right? How do you reconcile the universal claims of the gospel with the particularity of how it came to you? That's all that means is the Bible says it's for everyone. God loves everybody. He wants to rescue everybody, but then it comes to you in particular ways, right? You might, and I think the argument usually is taken where the way that it came to Africa was just wrong, right? So how do you make sense of that? And then Christianity, so many times, especially right now in the West, is seen to be on the wrong side of social issues, right? So when you're talking in the media, it's, you know, if you think, you know, like Christianly or the traditional way, you're seen as regressive and almost a part of the problem, right? So then, do Christians have any answers to the racial divides that exist, right? There are massive racial divides in our country right now, all over the world. Do Christians or does Christianity have any answers for us? I have a quote here from Blaise Pascal. It says, men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction, right? So I think the sentiment almost speaks for itself, right, of the evils that could have been done, which is a part of the problem. A lot of them were done in the name of religion, in the name of Christianity. And I got a couple more quotes here. It says, for many contemporary observers, the whole missionary enterprise epitomizes so much of what is wrong with Western culture. At their worst, missions are presented as a cynical arm of ruthless, racist, colonial exploitation. This is by Philip Jenkins, directly from one of his books. Here's another one. This is very popular. Desmond Tutu is usually given credit for this, but he wasn't the original person that said it. The name here, I would pronounce it, but it's recording, and if I get it wrong, I'm going to be embarrassed. So you can read it. But it says, when the missionaries came to Africa, they had the Bible, and we had the land. They said, let us pray. We closed our eyes. When we opened them, we had the Bible, and they had the land. All right. So I actually have one more. This is right. One of them is a Nigerian. And if you think that I am giving some preference to Nigerians in the lecture, you're correct. By a famous guy named Chinua Achebe. Yeah. Who said yeah? Man, we're friends already. I'm sorry. I'm just going to read what he said, and I'm going to read another quote. But it says, he's saying that he agreed that Christianity was part of the larger package of colonial intrusion. Pretty much, you know, these guys came to our country, they were intruding. The white man, the new religion, the soldiers, the new road, they are all part of the same thing. Right? And then I'll read another one. Here it says, held the Bible in the left hand and the gun in the right hand, the white man wanted us to be drunk with religion while he, in the meantime, was mapping and grabbing our land and starting factories and businesses on our sweat. Right? So we're just shaping the problem of how did we get here, right? So I think one of the big things that are part of the problem is, you know, Christianity and the Bible was used to condone slavery. And, you know, we have a history that slaves in America were deprived of Christianity, and or they were constantly preached that they were constantly preached and the Bible was used to get them to be good slaves, right? And I think, again, this is a quote from Jonathan Sacks: universalism is the cultural counterpart of imperialism, right? So as Christianity was taken abroad, it was used as a way of really just oppression, and it was bringing their, they just had multiple agendas. And although Christianity began in the Middle East, because of the Crusades and many other social phenomena, it was just, it's been seen that, you know, I guess there's a connection with just Europe, Christianity, Western thinking, and just lots and lots of bad, to be put simply. So this is the problem that we're trying to solve tonight. I'm also an engineer, so it's kind of like we think, like, we set the problem up and then we try to set a solution out, you know, later. So that's, some people come from the solution and they describe the problem. Because of my work, this is what I do. Right. More to the problem, evangelism and those who evangelize are seen as evil and a part of the imperialist past. Right. So I told a couple of my friends I'm going to go study apologetics, and they didn't know what that was, of course. And when they told me to explain it, I said, you know, it's just giving a reason, you know, for why you believe what you believe. And so they saw through that mask and they said, so wait, you're just trying to convert people, aren't you? So they took it as something very negative and almost a part of the imperialist past. Like, why would you even think to do that? Like, why? Like, you know, they have their truth, you have your truth. Like, and they just, you know, we've seen this already, right? When it happens, this happens. And so there just exists the perception that Christianity is European, Western, for the privileged, regressive, and against the common good. Right? So, and I could probably put a number of things, but we didn't have all night. So, how do we respond? How do we respond? How do we respond? So, as we set up the problem, I think Christianity has a universal vision where we would preach that the gospel is for all. And Christianity does not belong to a race. God loves and cares for us all, and he's at work to rescue us, right? And we would say that Christianity, we believe in a universal diagnosis of the human condition, and we have a universal problem, right? That, you know, we have sinned and fallen short of God's standards, and, you know, God came through Jesus to rescue us and set us free, right? And, so that's what we believe. We believe that it's universal. We believe that it's for everybody. You know, we don't believe that, you know, it's only for one race or for one gender. Whoever you are, you know, if you're a human, you have, God is here for you and he loves you and he wants to save you. Right? But just, we have a past history that it's coming from, and right now, how do you make sense of it? How do you make sense of it? We have this universal vision, but so many times, and then as I was thinking about this, I don't necessarily think that it's a new problem when it comes to Christianity, because Christianity from the onset was to be universal, right? So maybe if we were in Paul's time, Paul was, you know, railing against the Jews to say, hey, this is not a Jewish religion. It's for everyone, for the Gentiles too, you know, and then there were so many ways that in the early church that, you know, although we think that they're perfect and we're told that they're perfect so many times, if you actually read the Bible, you know, you see so many of the divisions that would have existed there in the early church and in the onset from a religion that is supposed to be universal. And when you actually see it, you know, coming from the particular, which are the Jews, for the whole world, they're just explosive problems, right? Like, and in trying to understand each other, how, you know, we think and how we act with this claim that God is here for us, for all, at all times, right? So it's always, I think, because Christianity is a universal faith religion, that we just have this problem, right? And so back then, that was their problem, and right now, this is our problem of how do we explain this? And I think I'm going to use this language. I read a book and trying to prepare for this, and I'm just going to steal a lot of his ideas. I'll give him credit. His name is Richard Bauckham. It's a great one. It's called Bible and Missions. And in him trying to explain it, he was saying that God moves from the particular to the universal in his salvation project, right? And that kind of went, the particular to the universals is God, he moves from, I want to say, how is it explained, particular and universal? So God has a plan for everyone, but when he is executing that plan, it comes through particular people or agents, right? So his plan is for everyone, and even his plan of salvation is for everyone, but it comes through particular people. And he says it's from particular to particular until we get to universal, right? So God could have came from a megaphone from the sky and said, hey, everyone, I'm here. You're wrong. I'm right. Bow down. Worship me. But he didn't do that, right? He comes all throughout history from particular agents, and then from the particular, he expands to the universal. All right? Please.
Actually, he did do that on the Mount Sinai.
Fair. 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 And then, as you said, from the single choice of the one, it expanded out to the many. Right? So God, you know, we were blessed and everything was good. We brought a curse, and then God says, I'm going to bless all families through Abraham. Right? So through Abraham's singular choice, you know, through Abraham, every family is going to be blessed. Right? And then God has now a nation, Israel, and God is going to reveal himself to the whole world through this nation, Israel. Right? So he has a universal vision, but it's coming through particulars. And then again, God's kingdom is coming. God's kingdom is to expand through the whole world, but it's coming through the particular kingdom of Zion. Right? And we'll just read some verses just so you don't think I'm making this up. Genesis 12, verses 1 and 2, it says, the Lord has said to Abram, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And I think in the Greek, if you're a biblical scholar, all means all. Right? Then we'll read Psalms 67, verses 1 to 3. May God be gracious to us and bless us and make his face to shine upon us, that your ways may be known on earth, your salvation among all nations. May the peoples praise you, O God. May all the peoples praise you. May the nations be glad and sing for joy, for you rule the peoples justly and guide the nations of the earth. Again, we're seeing here that God is revealing himself through the nations, through Israel. And then the last one, we'll read two verses. Actually, we'll just read one. This is Isaiah 45, verses 22 and 23. Turn to me and be saved, all you ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. By myself I have sworn, my mouth has uttered in all integrity a word that will not be revoked. Before me every knee will bow, by me every tongue will swear. And so God, he has a plan for to save everyone, but it's coming from the particular to the universal. So that's what we see God doing. But is that, and I guess within the history of Christianity at different times, I've heard people describe it where there's been accesses where, you know, the center of Christianity is where it started in the Middle East, and then, you know, the axis shifted to Europe. And what we see going on all over the world, especially that it was called the Global South, Africa, Latin America, and Asia, is where Christianity is exploding, right? And then at the same time, where Christianity was big before in Europe and America, it seems to be on the decline, right? And so now it's there's a tension of, you know, we have this problem of Christianity being seen, you know, as a white religion, and then we have God's claim to, I'm going to save everyone, I'm going to do it my way, which is from the particular to the universal. And then now we have, okay, well, how through this history and all that's going on, is that actually true? Right? Does it actually cause you to question? You know, how is this going to be done? And, you know, we read these great things of, you know, the kingdom of God being all nations, all peoples, all tongues, right? And I think as we see Christianity kind of shift and the access points move, it's almost, you know, we can see that, you know, Christianity is expanding and it's exploding, especially in the global south. This is taken from Philip Jenkins' book, The World Christian Database, and it's just showing, I guess, the across, you're going to see the years and then the numbers in millions of Christians, right? And you can see in 1900 there was 10 million, and then by they're projecting by 2050, that's a big number of million of Christians, right? They're projecting by, you know, right now, Latin America and Africa, they said by 2025, it's going to be a jostle for which nation has the most Christians, right? But they said by 2050, it's going to be, you know, a landslide. Africa wins, right? Africa is going to be the first continent that has a billion Christians on it, right? And so, you know, in one sense, depending on what spot in history you come, this argument, you know, Christianity is the white man's religion, might make more sense to you, right? And maybe if you're born in 2050 and someone says that to you, you'd be like, wait a second. I mean, what are you talking about? And so, you know, the gospel is going all over the world, and people from all nations and all tongues are coming in, families are being blessed. It's just Christianity is growing and exploding, right? So, but then still we have this sentiment of, it's not for me, it's the white man's religion. So how do we make sense of these numbers? How do we make sense of them? And so, yeah, we're living through a transforming moment in history where just of religion worldwide, especially Christianity. How do we make sense of the shift? And I think, again, what implications does it have on our evangelism and apologetics of, we see, you know, the access point of Christianity is shifting, right? There's going to be so many, I guess, more African. There's already the Christian presence right now in Africa is massive. Is massive. So how do we make sense of this? Go ahead.
Is there still a lot of syncretism going on, a mixing of paganism with Christianity among those Christian communities?
Yeah, I think it's hard to paint with a big brush. And I think, you know, in another part of the lecture, we're going to, I guess, you know, the brand of Christianity that's going on, there's a heavy emphasis on the supernatural. Mm-hmm. And I think so many times one of the reasons why Christianity is exploding the way that it is, this is an argument that Laman Sane is putting forth, is that because of the translation principle, where those cultures that kept the indigenous names for God, they were able to accept Christianity in an indigenous way, where I guess it was more, it was easier for them to understand and for it to be communicated to them, right? So I think, you know, at times there might have been syncretism with kind of both of them going at the same time, but I think, in my opinion, just over time, some of that goes away when there's a clearer understanding of God. And I think, you know, that scene, Laman Sane says, it's pretty much when the colonialists got out of the country, right? And you guys were kind of out of the way. Not you guys, meaning you, but like the Europeans. Like, okay, but could you leave? Now then we can kind of take, you know, God and what we see and connect with God in that way. Right? And so there's just been explosive things going on in the culture as people, I guess, as they find lines to Jesus and to the gospel from their particular situation, right? Because God is moving from the particular to the universal, and that's kind of how Christianity is spreading. Right, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, though, the syncretism, that's always been a question and an issue, mm-hmm. all the way back to the early church.
Mm-hmm.
Once the Roman leader became Christian, mm-hmm. You know, it took on a very European Roman flavor,
mm-hmm.
and Christ had said, don't have a hierarchy. You know, the servants, you know, we're servants. We're not going to be like your oppressors and like the world, where there's a big hierarchy. But what happened? The church became very hierarchical. It took on a very Roman flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very partial because this great, you know, now this great leader gave them rest from a lot of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always been that you know, tension,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the disciples wrote about it, and Paul would warn against it, you know, when there were Jews that were converted, you know. And he said, what do you say, forget those wives' tales and things, you know, like don't pollute the faith with that. And all through history, our movements always take on the flavor of the culture of the people. You have communism, but Russian communism looks very different from Chinese communism, which also looks very different from Cuban communism, you know, and it's the same thing with religion, depending on where you go. The way it is practiced in the Middle East is a little different from European, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When I was younger, and I was in college, I would hear this statement that Christianity is the white man's religion. I have two questions. One, I heard men saying that. It wasn't so much that women were saying that. Mm-hmm. It would be men that would be speaking that kind of language. The second thing I wanted to ask you is that, as a young man yourself, are you still hearing this in your circles, this discussion that Christianity is a white man's religion?
I'm hearing it, I guess, in a lot on social media, especially as mm-hmm. with what's happening with police brutality. It's almost like a "see, I told you so" mm-hmm. type of a way,
mm-hmm.
right? Oh man. You guys thought that they were gone. They're here again. They're coming to get you. And it's like, once you wake up and see that, you know, they have you in this Christian trance, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, you're kind of taking this thing sitting down, because, you know, they've enslaved you and then they've given you their God so that you're subservient to them. So I think there's that thinking is not necessarily gone. It might not be as overt. But I think as tensions rise, then I think you'll also hear that thinking on the rise. At least I'm hearing that amongst, you know, a lot of my friends and or colleagues, where it's almost, they were never first for us in the first place, right? So let's stop joking ourselves, almost.
But so there are, is it harder because when I grew up, you had your school, you had your parents, your grandparents, you had everybody helping you if you were in the faith. They were helping mm-hmm. you that way. These days, a lot of the young people are not in that place, and so they don't even have that foundation to help them to figure it out. And so I'm wondering if you find it more difficult to reach people who are not prone to believe that Christianity is universal.
And then I think even the language of reach would be the problem, right? Where stop trying to reach me, you know, like almost. In meaning, like in the sense of like, look, you think that, I think this, I think you're wrong, you're obviously confused, so just leave me alone, right? So
I have
it's like
a problem because you look so much like my son.
I'll give you a hug afterwards. You're making me feel really comfortable. I mean, thank you very much. So no matter what I say, you're gonna think it was great. So.
Why is it just Christianity? Because, I mean, in Africa now, in Nigeria, right? The Muslims, look at how they treat the Christians.
Mm-hmm.
They're slaughtering, them. So that's in the name of religion, too. So that wouldn't make that religion any more palatable people either.
Yeah. And I think sometimes there's a lot of myths and pre-existing ideas in people's minds where, people would say that Christianity was not on the continent of Africa at all before colonialism, which is not true, right? But a lot of times, I'm not patient enough. Well, a lot of some people don't know that who are Christians, and then two, I might not be patient enough to actually get you to say that. And if you say that and you don't back it up well, I'm just going to think you don't know what you're talking about, and you're just drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit more, and because you're just clearly in this Christian trance, and you're going to go pray and hold your Bible and cry by your bedside tonight. Go ahead.
Explain to me that I don't understand the connection between the violence against black men right now and Christianity, and that being a white man's religion. Mm-hmm. I don't see that connection.
Yeah. I'd say I don't want to quote Tupac during my lecture, but listen to the new Kendrick Lamar album. I don't know if you're into that, but at the end of it, Tupac is interviewing Tupac on some of the stuff that Tupac said before, right? And then so Tupac is pretty much saying, hey man, the poor people are tired of being oppressed, and if this doesn't stop, there's going to be war in the streets. Right, so I think what's happening is there's so much other issues that are not being highlighted and looked at, so that now almost the police brutality is like the lid almost bursting open, because it's like it's almost like you if you're sick inside, you can't see it. There's just been things rotting away at you. One day, boom, you just kind of drop. Because everything that's been going on inside is just, you haven't looked at it, you haven't taken the time to notice it or let it heal or even address it, right? So then now, when you see something overt that's happening, no matter what you say, all these things that have been inside and festering and these questions that you might have had, they kind of rise to the surface, right? I think I heard somebody say one time, if you bury your questions, it's going to come down and undermine your faith, right? Because it's just been there, and the faith can't really take root because you have these questions that are just kind of there and that are buried. And we're going to have a very lively question and answer time at the end. I love it that there's questions and but I might answer some of them, maybe. So are Africans, Asians, Latin Americans, and African Americans just taking on the religion of their oppressors? Right? Is that how we kind of explain we're seeing Christian explosion, and by and large, it's Christianity exploding outside of America and outside of Europe. So there's a couple ways to, explain and to respond. There's a lot of different strands. I think it's hard to give one answer to a social phenomenon that you see. I think, one, Christianity grew a lot from indigenous roots, like I was saying before, when a lot of the people where colonialism, when they left Africa, what happens was, because of translation, that's the translation principle that I have there as a key indicator, right? And one of Laman Sané's book is called Whose Religion is Christianity? Christianity Outside of the West, right? He has a particular place where he shows that those cultures within Africa that were able to keep the indigenous roots of God, Christianity, I would say, exploded. And then those cultures that did not keep the indigenous names of God, it was harder for Christianity to really take root in those areas. And I'd say many connected with the gospel through their cultural particularities. There's a book called Jesus and the Disinherited by Howard Thurman. And he's kind of looking at Jesus and how he connects with so many different people, especially the poor and those who are marginalized and oppressed. And so he kind of frames Jesus in those terms, because so many times, especially I'd say in Africa through colonialism, Christianity was seen with the winners almost, and that's kind of what Christianity was associated with. But then, you know, Howard Thurman in a beautiful way kind of roots Jesus in, you know, in a way where I would say that people who are poor and oppressed can see the lines that God is for me. God has come and he's here to help me. And then Philip Jenkins, he has very provocative ways of explaining the growth of Christianity. And one of the most things I found interesting, I was listening to one of his lectures, and he was saying that demography is one of the key factors that you have to look at in just the growth and expansion of religion. And he was saying that he can come and he can look at a country's fertility rate and almost nail what religion they are. And he was saying that by and large in Europe, with secularism, their fertility rate is 2.1 or below, right? And if your fertility rate is 2.1 or below, right, he can tell that, okay, this is secularism. But then if it's 2.1 and above, it's usually Christian, right? So then now he goes in his lecture, he's just quoting, I don't know how he knows all the top of his head, but he's just quoting countries' fertility rates, and, you know, he's, you know, that this is their country's fertility rate. Obviously, secularism is exploding there. And then, you know, this is like for, I think he said Uganda's fertility rate is like 6.1, right? So, like, their country just exploding. And he said, okay, what's happening now, right? So he says Italy's fertility rate is lower than 2.1. What's their median age? 42. What's the median age of Uganda? 14, right? So he's showing now, because Africa has Christianity has taken indigenous roots within Africa. I think on the next slide, and it's right here, where the Christianity versus Islam expansion in Africa, where Africans converted to Christianity over Islam at a rate of 4-1, right? At a rate of. I'm not, you know, I got to do this. I'm sorry, because you clap. Because I'm not used to, like, a lot of times if you're in the black church, like, the black church ones, they're going to heckle you down and clap when they hear something good. But sometimes when you go to, like, Caucasian churches, they don't do that. It just hit me, man. Because I'm talking about race, I can just do that right now. It's fine. Right? But thank you for that, you know. So Philip Jenkins and fertility and demography. So I think it's, and so he, and then you, when you add in immigration, right, he's showing, I can't remember the exact country, but there's two countries specifically in Europe where, because of immigration, well, one, their population is an older population, so who's going to pay taxes, right? What do you have to do? You have to import people to work, right? And so you're importing people from other nations, specifically Africa, and what are they bringing you? They're bringing you their Christianity, right? So I can't remember the country, but there's a European country where there's four mega churches all ran by Congolese in Europe, right? And then there's another European country where there's three mega churches all ran by Nigerians, right? Hard for Nigerians. another country. I don't know where y'all are. Actually, why? What's happening with, I guess, the spread, or even the spread of religion in Europe and in other countries where Christianity is declining, it's where Christianity has taken indigenous roots in Africa and other countries. They're taking it abroad as they immigrate. So fertility rate, I think, you know, as secularism spreads, you know, Philip Jenkins is making the connection of, you know, their fertility rates drop off because they're concerned about other things. But So I just thought it was fascinating. And then the brand of Christianity that's growing abroad, one of them, I think, is Pentecostalism, where there's a heavy belief in the spiritual, and there's a lot of traditional views and values. So I think so many times when we think about Christianity, what comes into our minds, that image is going to be changing in the future because of where Christianity is exploding. And, you know, Philip Jenkins, he gives a lot of examples of, you know, like the Anglican Church or the Episcopalian Church, where they're trying to dictate what's going to happen within the religion in Africa. And they're like, wait a second. You know, there's about two of y'all, 100 of us, and y'all sitting here telling us what to do? So it's just, it's what's happening is just, it's fascinating.
Those are two different types of Christianity. Those are both describing the type that exploded. Is that right?
Yeah, that's you know, blowing up. So, so I think that these are some ways to make sense of what we see going on abroad. Yeah, please.
Can you define traditional
Jesus values? So that was a nice way of saying Africans aren't really accepting homosexuality, and you're not going to shove it down their throat, right? So the kind of Christianity that is going on over there, when there's, I'd say, when there's tension in social issues in the West, that tension isn't necessarily felt in Africa, because there's a, what do you mean you're going to do that over here? In the church? No way. So, you know, that's kind of...
Does that apply to having multiple girlfriends or boyfriends or things like that? Married people having multiple partners?
I'm trying to decide how to answer that question. I want to say it one way, but... I think the lines that, you know, the gospel takes within a culture, how do I say that? The simple answer is yes.
Yes, what?
Yes, where the Christianity is affecting polygamy. Right, I guess to just get it straight to the point. it can be a little bit more of a complicated answer, but, you know... Yeah. So, and the reason why I was trying to explain the Christian explosion in these terms, because if we bring it back to the topic of Christianity, the white man's religion, so many times, you know, the growth of Christianity abroad is explained away by just, you're just accepting the religion that was given to you by these outsiders. But when you take a look at what's going on, there's many reasons why, you know, people would convert. And even if you look at, you know, the African Americans in America converting to Christianity from slavery, right? There's so many ways that the gospel inspired, and at one point in Lama Sane's book, he says that Christianity helped Africans to be more African, right? And before this talk, one of my very close family friends, their father, they're Ghanaian. This is being recorded. You might hear this. I'm going to go for it. So their father is, he has this view, very dominant, right? Because, you know, even for my parents, they almost, you know, the Christian missionaries that were there, they knew them, right? And so, like, you know, the Christian missionaries, they came to Africa, they set up schools, did all these things. So, like, you know, my parents were children when all this stuff was going on. So, I'm just trying to sit down and ask them about, you know, how was it, what happened, you know, because they were there when this was actually going on. So Sunday, I was back home, and so I'm going to go talk to them and kind of interview them, say, hey, I'm doing this talk and just want to talk to you about your thoughts. And so when he was explaining, I asked him the question, with all the evil that was done, why did we accept Christianity, right? And he obviously chuckled, because at first, in a cynical way, he said, well, they brought schools, you know, and hospitals, and money. So, I mean, so he said that almost in like a, I mean, of course, what do you mean? They're educating us, they're giving us all these things. Oh, just God too? Oh, fine, sure, right? So, he said it in that way, and then so I asked him, is Christianity actually doing any good for people that are there, or is it just, you know, you take what they had, and, you know, they told you to praise God, so yeah, you praise them, right? But then what he said to me was so interesting. He said that we in Africa, we knew God as well, but it was just in a different way. And then he was explaining how, just as the Jews had their ways of sacrifice, and they had a respect, because he was saying, you know, the difference between Africa and America is, you know, in America they might just say God doesn't exist, but no one is going to say that in Africa, right? He was just going to say so. And when, like he was saying, that in Ghana and Nigeria they had, you know, what their belief of pouring libations is what he called it, where, you know, what they would do was when they would pour libations, they would pour libations first to the gods above, and then second you pour libations to the gods on the earth. So they're almost respecting the God that is there, who is above us. And so what he was saying was, and so there's such a rich, vivid belief in the spiritual. So now when Christianity came, you're already believing in the spiritual, and you believe in all these evil and good forces, right? So when you're pouring libations, you're pouring libations to what's above, to what's beneath, and there's so many almost gods that you have to appease. But what Jesus gave us was, Jesus says that he's God above all, right? So we know that there's evil forces, but Jesus says, I'm God above all of those things, right? So it's like, now I don't have to pour libations to both. We're already aware that there's a God above here, but now it's almost, there's a God with a name, right, that we can call for everything, right? So, and so that's almost, you know, and then Lama Sani puts it, it just helps Africans to be more African. Like we believe in God, right? We believe that he's there. So you're like, we're not going to hit you with like 10 points of atheism and, oh, he doesn't exist at all. No, he's here, right? But, you know, it's, now there's a God with a name. Right, so when he was telling me that, I was just like, man, wow, that was good. So like I said, you know, again, another explanation for the Christian explosion is just Jesus. You know, there's so many people where, because it's still an agricultural society, I'd say the Bible still makes more sense to them, right? Because you can say shepherd or farming, and we're actually doing it, so we get the analogy. We're here. You know, the last time I saw a farm was a long time ago. So the examples that are given, the culture that it's speaking to, and then again, just connecting with Jesus for myself, right? And I think that was a great question you asked, where, you know, there's so many, you know, poor and marginalized women who are flooding into Christianity in Africa because of how they're seeing Jesus treat them. Right, and then, you know, it's like, you know, Jesus almost for the oppressed, for the poor, for the marginalized. It's powerful, where it's like, you know, it's actually giving me hope. It's helping me to live my life, right? So it's not just, you know, take the Bible and the gun, although that was happening. But, you know, when the claims of Christianity are taken seriously, it's going to explode, right? Go ahead.
With Islam, women are cattle.
I'm not going to speak on that one. So, like I said, there are numerous reasons why there are so many conversions, right? So sometimes we're trying to be pigeonholed to say, you know, they're converting just because of this or that. But I think if you really take a look at the facts, to the people who are actually converting and what's actually going on, there's numerous reasons, right? And so I said, so the Christian expansion and conversion, it does not make it true. So I think that's sometimes you try to overextend an argument, right? So just because you're saying, oh man, look at all these people flowing into Christianity, right? So someone can on the back end say, well, it doesn't make it any more true, right? They're just using it because they're poor, right? But I think it's definitely worth noting, because, you know, sometimes people try to take it to just explain it in, you know, almost, you're an opportunist, so you're taking what it's giving you, as opposed to it actually affecting your daily life and, you know, changing you and helping you to live better, right? So, but I think, you know, this part of the Christian explosion, I think it helps us in the thought process of Christianity being the white man's religion, because we see Christianity taking indigenous roots across the world, devoid of colonialism, where Christianity is actually helping and changing people. But I think we overextend if you say, oh yeah, can't you see it? Right? I think it helps and it's worth noting, but I don't think it makes it true. And then I think, but I do think that it bolsters the thought that Christianity is not restricted by race, right? Because especially, like I said, in 2050, you know, the vision of who or what a Christian is, you know, is going to be a poor African woman, you know, as opposed to being dominated by white people. All right. And then just some thoughts and some points on racial reconciliation. So when I'm challenging myself because sometimes when I meet people, I guess if you were looking for like a magic bullet to just give someone when they give you this, when they say Christianity, they're living white man, oh, I know how to respond now. I don't necessarily think, because for me, even looking at the information and looking at the facts, I'm coming away with sometimes I feel like more questions than answers. But I think it's exciting to see Christianity taking indigenous roots abroad. And I do think that Christianity, we know that it has done a lot for reconciliation through the civil rights movement, what's done in South Africa. So, you know, it actually has happened and hasn't been easy or an easy process. But I think if you know people who think like this and you're trying to, I guess, thinking how to respond, right, I think one of the things that is helpful for racial reconciliation is a clear proclamation, right? So many times, you know, if you're doing evangelism, there has to be a time where you proclaim what the truth is. And so many times on both sides, I can't proclaim what your problems and issues are, right? So a lot of times, like for example, I think bringing it back to police brutality, when everything was going on and the cases were mixed up and it's hard to kind of see the facts and make sense of it, you know, there are so many people who want to be so loud and champion so many other causes, but they couldn't, you know, give me a clear proclamation that police shouldn't kill black people. Just please, just say that, right? Proclaim, you know, so okay, we don't understand the facts of the case, we don't do this, we don't do that, but almost when we're talking about racial reconciliation, if there is just a clear word of what should be and how we should behave. So many times, I think, within different circles, you know, Christian circles, there can be, you know, just please, just give me a clear proclamation of how things should be done. And I want to say it helps to build the sense that you know what the issues are and you're for me. Right? Because so many times, you know, in the broader culture, we're pitted against each other. Right? But then we're told we're brought into a community of where people love me and who are for me. But if you can't proclaim what is right versus what is wrong, it's hard for me to really accept that and hear that. I think another thing that... Go ahead.
Sounds like you're referring to the need for validation, you know, that you're seeing as a black race and that they have the right to be protected from violence. Is that what you're saying?
I think more what I'm saying when it comes to social injustice, right? So many times it's hard to have a clear word. Mm-hmm. And I think the way I said it like that is because maybe I'm just trying to tie it back to evangelism. And when we're told to evangelize, you know, you want that time where you give a clear word for something. And not necessarily... validation, as in, you know, I need you to tell me that I'm somebody, because no, I don't think anyone does.
I'm referring
right.
to
but I think
where you're out, every human being has needs and rights, and when those are expressed, those are validated.
Mm-hmm,
you know
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying?
Well, and
important.
I.
Every human
yeah.
being needs validation.
I think what you're saying is, and kind of together, is that you're saying Christianity just needs to, let's say in America with all the injustice going on, the killing or whatever, the Christian voice should rather than being like trying to explain away and then focus on, well, the reaction to it, just come out first of all and say, that is not God's plan, that is not God's will. We as a Christian community, we condemn violence against, you know, people, you know, you know, in social injustice, violence against people, murder, just, you know, based on race or anything. Like, that's not Christianity. We're not just going to side with, try to figure out loopholes to try to side with, you know, let's say the police because, you know, culturally we feel more connected. You know,
that's what my understanding of validation is.
Yeah.
It happens in every relationship. Yeah. Human beings in general.
And I think I heard Gary Haugen, he said that in fighting injustice, that, you know, your voice is very powerful, right? And just giving your voice is very powerful in the fight against injustice. And I think at least what's because of televangelists and so much that's done in the media with Christianity, right now when you come into the oppressed, they don't have as strong of a voice as people who are not oppressed. Right? So now, when someone who is not oppressed lends their voice on the side of those who are oppressed, I think it's very powerful. Right? And so many times, you know, people are, you know, in just different, you know, if I'm oppressed, I don't have as much power, or my voice isn't as loud or as strong, so I need you almost in a sense to speak for me, right? So that's also what I'm saying, you know, a clear proclamation. But so many times, the message from the media that we get from Christianity, right, you know, you're saying so many different things, but then when it comes to a big social issue, right, and then maybe I just don't watch the right channels, but it's like, okay, where were you now, right? Where was your voice for this, right? You're going to ask for my money, but come on. All right, sorry, that was a jab. So, and I think, you know, another thing on racial reconciliation is respecting / acknowledging systematic oppression. And before preparing for this talk, I don't think I would have wrote that. I think, you know, even myself, I had to educate myself on what that actually really means. Right, and then I had to ask myself the question: is this biblical? Where we should acknowledge faulty systems and work to try to fix them? And I think what I was thinking about was like Joshua 7, Daniel 9, and Romans chapter 5, where, you know, Joshua 7. You have the story of Achan, and sometimes when you read it, it's very disturbing because you think, wait, Achan did something wrong and everyone else paid for it, right? But I think what that is, at least what it was saying to me about systematic oppression and why we should care about it and why God cares about it is that, you know, we think very individualistically, but God, you know, he thinks communally and he cares about the community. And, you know, I think in so many other cultures, they know that you and your decisions are not just the result of you. They're the result of, you know, your parents and everyone that you were in community with who lets you do things versus not let you do things. And now when you're kind of coming onto the society, you know, it's not just you, right? There's so much that goes into that, right? So I was thinking, yeah, so I think that's one. And then in Daniel 9, we see Daniel repenting almost for the sins of his father and his forefathers, right? Almost in a sense, acknowledging that was there, right? But so many times, you know, when we talk about race issues, too many people are so quick to divorce themselves from that. Oh, that's not me. You know, I didn't do that, mm-hmm. right? But it's like, you know, wait a second. First of all, I didn't say you did, but, you know, if we want to be technical.
There's another scripture I can think of that backs up what you're saying, too. And I believe it should be done with humility and love, but it says that if your brother sins, rebuke him, lest you take part in his sin.
Mm-hmm. And then I think the last one was Romans chapter 5, where, you know, where I guess we're kind of clearly shown that, you know, Adam and Eve sinned, and the whole human race was involved in that, right? And then what it shows us on the other side is Jesus came and didn't sin, and everyone who accepts that is involved in that. So I think, you know, just at least looking at it and saying, we can't just turn a blind eye and not address systematic oppression. And so many times, you know, you walk into a church and you try to say that. It's huh? What are you talking about? You know, that's like 100 years ago, right? But then now, so I think, and then there's almost levels of responsibility, right? Because there's, you know, you can say, one, the person responsible is those who almost intentionally set the system up and they know what's going on. Right? I think that's the top level. And then probably the bottom level is those who don't know and don't care to know, right? And then in between those two, you have, you know, probably the person who's kind of passively gaining from the way the system was set up, right? And then, you know, so I think to just turn a blind eye and pretend that it doesn't exist, I think maybe that's a lot of times is so much more damaging, right? So I think that's why if you begin with a proclamation to proclaim, you actually have to know what's going on, right? And then, you know, so many times Christians, I'm saying Christians, like I'm not one, I'm one too, so this is to me too. They, when you start talking about systematic oppression, it's like, whoa, the gospel didn't tell me to listen to that. I just thank Jesus, I'm saved, I'm going to heaven, raising my kids. Systematic, what? So like, you just don't even acknowledge it, you don't look at it, you don't speak to it. And then when we start talking about it, huh? Is that in the Bible? It's like, I think we're responsible for the systems that we create, right? And you know, you have something to say, go ahead.
First, I want to thank you. Doing this, guys. It's a great eye opener. It's a good talk to the question back here earlier and to the other question up front about polygamy. But why does police brutality, what does that have to do with this when you talk about systematic oppression? And you mentioned the clear proclamation. And to be precise, where sin is, okay, it's not so much of a race thing. It's just a situation, a sin pattern, where we come with the truth of the gospel. I have no right to dictate what you have to do. I tell you with the gospel, and I share with the gospel with you. And that person, at their time, with the God's moving on their life, they will decide to change. But then when you have a person who's living the life, who's showing constantly, that's why missionaries are important, because they are there, working beside, living with them. And the people see visual gospel living before them. The oppression, systematic oppression is so scary. Just to throw this out, I watched something, a documentary about racism in America. And if you really heard what they were saying, it's scary. I understand them. I understand they have nowhere to go to. No one wants to hear them. And when we continue to see young black men shot, okay, they would not want to go to the system, but that's where we come in, with the truth of the gospel. The Korean, that was wrong, but it's not just a white person, it's the heart condition. And that's where we can get it off the race situation and allow them to see the truth of the gospel.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think, go ahead, you'll be the last one, and I'm going to finish this, and then we're going to talk. I think so. I think. Let me just say the question back to you, see if I got it. So you're saying a part of not acknowledging systematic oppression is now we have to blow the whole ship up almost, right? Because
well,
we got it wrong, totally wrong.
The founding fathers are quote-unquote acknowledged to be Christian, right? And so then the Constitution and all of the things, like, historically speaking, like, they're supported. So then all of these, you know, oh, this country was founded on Christian values, this country was founded on this Christian thing. And, and so then I think sometimes there's a fear of challenging that by saying, actually, but our country was also founded on racial prejudice and slavery. So how do you make those two bump up against each other and acknowledge the reality of that and not, like you said, blow up the whole ship dealing with that?
Wow. well, I think when if we, I think on a, there is sometimes when you create systems, you get it wrong, and you have to blow it up, right? Because it was just wrong. Like organizations go through reorganizations all the time, and they reorganize again, right? So I don't think that what you're saying necessarily, like, they're one and the same, where, you know, because again, if we're just speaking about truth, and if we say, okay, actually in truth and in fact, we got this part wrong, I don't see why that says we have to, you know, speak to, you know, we actually got this part right, right? So I think that, you know, you can kind of clearly say what you got wrong and what you got right, if you want to be honest. Right, so I think almost, this is something I learned from Ben last time, humility and honesty kind of go together. Right, so I think sometimes we don't want to be honest because we're arrogant. Right, but no one ever gets it all right all the time. And, you know, that's kind of what I think about that. But then I think, you know, when it comes back to at least one of the main women that changed my mind or just opened my eyes to systematic oppression was Michelle Alexander in her book, The New Jim Crow, right? And so when she speaks to what's going on in a very, very, very clear way and kind of traces the history of ideas and kind of roots it for you and then illuminates to where we are, I think, you know, these are things where, and sometimes, admittedly, you know, it's hard for quote-unquote religious bodies or the church to champion political causes, so it kind of gets dicey. But I think for me, if we want to talk about just reconciliation almost on a grassroots level, right, like I think at least know, be knowledgeable about what's going on. Because so many times when you have this conversation, I think because it's not overt, where there's not a big sign that says whites only, right, it's that doesn't mean it's okay. That doesn't mean that, you know, that racism is gone. That doesn't mean that there isn't systematic oppression, right? But I think so many times, if you're just, you know, having a conversation one-to-one, right, and you start speaking like that, you know, it's like, what are you talking about? So I think that what are you talking about response almost, I'd say, if we want to talk about love and care for people, we're Christians, I love you, I care for you. If you don't know what my problems are, what are you talking about that you love me, right? You don't know anything I'm going through. You can't see the world through my eyes. So you're, I love you, and you play your C chord to tell me to sing and raise my hands. I'm over that, you know? So I don't really take you that seriously, right? So, you know, I think again, right, if you're talking about apologetics and evangelism, when you're learning apologetics, they tell you that you should, a loving way is to learn the other's world and learn their arguments and learn their world and be able to express their world to them, right? So sometimes it's so clear on a worldview level when it's abstract, but in reality, actually, I'm sitting here hurting and dying, and you don't think it's important to learn my world? All right. So yeah, then the other one is just understand the world through each other's eyes, right? So I think, you know, again, we have to work to do that. And then I think also, I put this one, less self-righteousness of those championing the cause, right? So I think so many times, you know, the ones who are actually championing the cause of systematic oppression, and they're speaking to those things, they're just not that nice. You know, they're just very
angry.
You know, like,
you mean the people who are against systematic oppression?
Yes, and those who are that I guess the imagery, like, if you paint yourself a picture of what do you think this person will look like who's telling me that, you know, the system is broken, right? It's usually someone who's just, I say they're self-righteous because it's like, man, I'm here, I'm fighting, and you guys are just sleeping and, you know, not really for the cause and helping what's going on. So I think sometimes it would be easier to accept and to hear it if the spirit in kind of what you're doing it is a little less self-righteous. But I don't necessarily think angry is the word, because in a sense, you know, there's something to be angry about. So if I'm mad, I'm mad, right? But, you know, just don't, you're not better than me because you're doing something, you know, that they're, I mean, I'm sorry. I'm still thinking about that point in my own head. If you haven't noticed, that's why I'm fumbling. But I think there's something there, but maybe in the question and answer, they'll go. Okay, all right. And I think the last one, there's so much more that can be said on racial reconciliation, and there's a lot of people who do speak to it. But I think, you know, seeing real communities that have real diversity is something that's very helpful, you know, especially within Christianity, where the Bible says, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another. And, you know, Sunday mornings, we just don't see that, just to be real. So, like, and there's so much that actually goes towards having real community. And I think it's very hard, but it's not seen a lot. You just don't see it. And so I think that's one of the, especially if you're speaking in a way where you're telling me you're trying to reconcile, but like I said, you don't know anything about me. You don't know my world. You're just saying, oh man, come, Jesus loves you. What are you talking about? Like, you're not for me. Right? So just everything you're saying, it's almost, it gets relativized when you start opening your mouth and you start speaking and you start showing me that actually, you know, you don't care about me. You say you love me, but you don't. And I'm actually seeing it. And I think a way, if there was more real community where there is real diversity, right? Like, sometimes, you know, like, diversity and inclusion is like a champion, especially in corporate America right now, and everyone's talking about it. But, you know, so many times it's like you have your token diverse person. So, yeah, we're diverse now. You're not. You're not. So please, like, get over it. You're just not. Be honest. Look, there's either 10 black people and you're token white guy, or there's 10 white guys and you're token black person, and if you're really lucky, you're token Asian. So let's be real here. This is not a real community. Please, give me a break. So,
are
go ahead.
Now,
almost. Okay. You need to go, be done so you can talk?
No.
I'm joking. I like to have fun, man. You were talking to me, I'm talking to you, so. Come back. So I think, I'll read a verse and then conclude. I should have found the verse, but I'll just make reference to it. Because sometimes we are encouraged, and I ask myself, is there any reason for hope? Right? Do you see any lines of encouragement? And so I always have to come back to, you know, Christianity, and this is, God is actually really at work in the world, because God cares for us and He loves us, and He wants to have heaven be all nations, all peoples, all tongues, right? So I think so many times there was wrongs, and there are wrongs being done in the name of religion and Christianity, but because, you know, God is transcendent, He's above us and He's over us, and He cares for the world, He cares for human beings, you know, He is at work to communicate His message of love to everyone, right? And I think that, for me, is one of the most encouraging and most powerful things, is even through the blunders of that we might do when we're evangelizing or whatever it is that we're doing, God is still at work, and he's sovereign, and he's over us. And that vision that is given to us of all people, all nations, all tongues, God is actually working to accomplish it. And I think if our eyes are open to see what's going on around us, you know, we can be encouraged where we are still living in the weeds of the fall, but, you know, we can be encouraged because even, you know, God is going to do that, right? He is going to do that. And I think what's more encouraging is he's going to do it through us, right? Because God works through from particular to bring the universal, right? So as we take the message of Christ and where we need to go, God is working through your particular situation, through your particular story. And there's so many stories, you know, and I think when you're reading how Christianity was spreading through Africa after colonialism, right, you see that, you know, it was the person next door, when they were praying, God answered their prayer. What did they do? They went and knocked on their next neighbor. Oh, my goodness. You know, I was praying and God answered my prayer. You should pray too. Right? Oh, and then, oh, maybe this God thing is real. Right? And then as God starts to move, you know, his message gets spread, you know, from particular to particular in communities, you know, through families, through nations, through. So God is at work. So there was, you know, wrongs and evils done. But I think just we are seeing that God is bigger than that. Right? So that God is bigger than that.
How bigger?
God is bigger than that. So thank you all for paying attention and kindly cutting me off for a second. Go ahead, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
After all, our lectures, we have free-for-all discussion, but it can go on for quite a while, because he's still got some energy, I think. But everybody should be free to just take off when you get tired or when you have to leave. Don't think you have to stay until the discussion ends, because you won't be offending anybody. But don't let the person dominate discussion. Let him check around and get questions from different people.
I've got a question. In your mind, is the criticism that Christianity is a white man's religion, is that coming primarily from the West, from America, from Europe, or are there voices of that in Global South, say in Africa? Because I'm just wondering whether there's actually that itself is a deeply condescending thing to say as a Westerner. All these people over there are just drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah,
it's not taken seriously. The fact that they are people with minds and are people who are able to see colonial oppression themselves. And maybe are accepting this God for their own reasons. To me, it's just kind of, if it's this voice coming from the West, I don't know if it is, but it seems to me like it just seems quite condescending. almost in itself a colonialist attitude.
And I think that's a great question, and there are plenty of voices who are saying that in Africa, right? There's actually one of like the Ghanaian like pop stars just wrote an article. I was gonna read it, but I just didn't have time to pull it up. But you know, she pretty much wrote an article saying this, right? What are we doing, trying to free Ghanaians from this Christian myth, right? So she's a pop star. She has a big voice in the country, and you know, there's a church on every corner in Ghana. But like, she's got, guys, what are we doing? And I think especially like my family friend who I was talking to, he's an older gentleman. So I think especially among men in Africa, especially older men who were seeing, I guess, firsthand what was going on, like a lot of them, they've been really resistant to that. And I think in a lot of places, Kenya, South Africa, it's almost like while Christianity is exploding, there are roots of, guys, what are we doing? Just kind of springing up at the same time. So it's almost like they're growing together. So that's why I think, you know, just this way of thinking and responding, I would hope, is also springing up in Africa at the same time, because it's almost like as generations come, if this springs up too big and there's no one there to respond, it's just going to be easy to kind of shift, you know, the way, the axis of thinking. So I think prayerfully somebody is, you know, responding in a clear way. So go ahead.
I'm curious your thoughts. It seems kind of this evening we haven't touched on kind of how Christians
have been really at the forefront of fighting systematic oppression, whether it's slavery, William Wilberforce.
Sure.
You know, the Christian worldview is the very reason we fought a war with mm-hmm. ourselves mm-hmm. to get rid of, you know, the abolishing slavery. Mm-hmm. It was Christians behind the, you mm-hmm. know, the anti-segregation and civil and for the civil rights. So I'm mm-hmm. kind of curious what your thoughts are on that. Where I feel like it's a huge piece of history that's not talked about. Like, mm-hmm. Christians have been on the right side. Mm-hmm. And then my second question was, you mentioned a clear proclamation, and if, tell me if I'm wrong, it sounded like you said, like, even if you don't have the facts or the story, you should still be able to proclaim something. Mm-hmm. How do you proclaim something and make a stand if you don't really know what the issue is and you're not informed?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess I'll take the second question first. When I was saying to a clear proclamation, I wasn't trying to say speak without having the facts, right? I think what I was saying is that so many times, and then I think the police brutality is what's kind of at the forefront of people's minds and just everyone's minds. But I think just even if you, I guess, remove that situation, right, there are so many things where, and I think I'm kind of just using Gary Haugus' way of thinking of you need to use your voice for the oppressed. And it needs to be very clear, right? Because they're oppressed and they're marginalized. And one of the biggest things that you can do to help fight injustice is use your voice, right? So I think I'm stealing that from one of his books that I read where he was talking about just, you know, how they're setting up the International Justice Mission overseas, right? And he's saying, the group that I'm a part of in Connecticut, Diving Deeper, we were actually helping them do advocacy in Connecticut. And so just talking to the rep, right, it's almost like you're saying, well, is anything that we're doing making an effect? But he was saying, well, by you guys just using your voice to help get on the side of justice is making a big effect. So I think I was just saying a clear proclamation because, especially in the media when it comes to the Christian worldview, there's so many things that are clear. We want your money is very clear, right, in the media when it comes to Christianity, right? Please pay us money because we need it, right? But what's not clear all the time is we are not racist, right? Because, you know, if you look at the mega churches so many times, or you look at, you know, these big movements, you know, like, for example, on Sunday morning, just do a test, right? Turn on to, like, one big Christian station. There's going to be the white church time and the black church time, right? Why? You know, like, why? And then, so I think that's what I mean more towards a clear proclamation is, I'm not saying speak if you don't have the facts, speak if you don't know anything about the issue, but, you know, there's so much that in the media that Christians are talking about, right, but the things that is not really clear, and I say that just more so because, you know, if you're in the neighborhood, right, if you're trying to evangelize in an inner city neighborhood and you're talking about Christianity, the first thing that they're going to say back to you is they're not really for us. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they don't hear a clear proclamation. Mm-hmm. Right, and then I'm not saying, and I think, you know, to the, almost going to the first question, there's definitely, you know, been, you know, Christianity has been a tool. I kind of mentioned it in passing. I didn't really, you know, speak to it, but the civil rights movement, what happened with racial reconciliation in South Africa, mm-hmm. bigly strong, I mean, you know, Christianity was a big catalyst for that. William Wilberforce and all these guys that were championing it. But I think the problem when you're talking with someone who, I guess, they're not Christianity's biggest fan, is as you have William Wilberforce and a couple others sprinkled there. I'm sure there's more, but then they're going to throw in your face these big colonial ships that came into Africa in the name of Christianity. So it's almost like, you know, yeah, we can say, well, we've done good and we've helped out, got you, right? But then again, it's like I was reading an article by Mark Knoll to get ready for this. His question was, has Christianity done more, you know, like more evil than good in the world? So that, I think, you know, when we're getting there, there's definitely stories and there's definitely ways that the Christian worldview has been a catalyst towards racial reconciliation and towards helping the world and doing massive amounts of good. But it's almost, I guess, it's hard to find the balance because on one hand, there's so much, there's lots and lots of wrong and evil that's been done. There's lots and lots of good. So I guess it's just, how do you find a tipping point to, you know, balance yourself? But I think, and I think, but I just think it's, it goes to just acknowledging both sides of the story. Go ahead.
I would like to add, though, a clear proclamation is good and necessary, but if all you give is a clear proclamation and nothing behind it, it's worthless. Mm-hmm. So I would add that as Christians, remember the phrase of faith without works, and the things that I think you talk about are, yeah, you said something, but you never did it.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, there, this page can be filled with more, you know, reconciliation ideas. I was just, I had said so much else, I just wanted to give a couple of notes, but I definitely agree. Go ahead.
I think just reflecting on the question about systematic oppression and kind of where do Christians stand, I think, I don't know, a big question that popped up as you were talking about it was that, what systems are we creating for ourselves, either in this country or in other countries, that are creating space for the need to do what Jesus taught? So, for example, are we responsible for creating more poor people? You know what I mean? Like, and there will always be poor, and there will always be, and, you know, we have been given a, you know, directive in terms of what to do. But when are we responsible for creating more of a problem that the Bible teaches us how to address from a Christian standpoint? And then what is our response to that? So that sense of like, well, do we need to talk at all about any sort of systemic oppression? Well, is this creating something that we're just like, great, need to be doing this? And he was telling us that about, I think specifically for myself, I think about the prison industrial complex in this country, and I think, what am I doing to, like, why am I putting myself one step forward and two steps back as a Christian?
Yeah.
And, like, what am I buying into that is antithetical to my
beliefs? And I think that's a hard question. I gotta get my thoughts. Are you guys something to say to that?
Or no.
Please go for it.
But just a very quick thing. But one of the definitions of an institution, I mean, we're talking about systematic oppression or institutional oppression. One of the definitions of an institution is that it's invisible. It's something invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we're not going to be likely to see it clearly. Because it's just a part of the way our culture is shaped. We haven't known it any different. Mm-hmm. So we need to be patient with people unable to see the system that's there.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the best biblical example is Amos, who just nailed system after system after system, and nation after nation after nation. We've got no out to not have eyes to see systematic patterns of oppression and injustice and so on. That are, if we look at the biblical prophets, they have, you know, no patience at all with not being able to suss this out. But we need to be careful as well. We need to be accurate. We need to really understand.
Quick.
Just thinking about the topic, just speaking from my personal experience, the first time I ever even heard of the white man's religion being associated with Christianity was in the film Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. And it's a very powerful film, and if you really want to kind of see a film that speaks about this particular topic throughout the whole film, they kind of deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the most powerful scene in the film was, to me, he was going to give a lecture at a university, and a young white student, young lady, came to him and asked him, you know, she said, I'm a good white person, I believe in what you're trying to do, I believe in the fact that you're trying to do, I just want to know, what can I do to help? And his response was very coldly and very shortly, nothing. And I think that is the issue when it comes to the white man's religion being a topic, being a thought process, particularly in the African-American community. Because, just giving an example, when I see it on social media, just like you saw it, I think that you associate it with racial oppression, you associate it with police brutality, because it's the easiest thing for them to do. They look at a white face being the oppressor when it comes to slavery, a white face being the oppressor when it comes to segregation in the Ku Klux Klan. So I see a white cop getting away, it was murder of a black man, I see that face, I associate it with Christianity because that's the easiest thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem that we have is that as an African American community, we haven't taken steps to get away from that same response that this is my issue, this is what I'm dealing with, how can you help me? There's nothing you can really do. And I think until we break down that barrier collectively, I think this will always be an issue with Christianity. Mm-hmm.
I disagree with some of that in the sense that I think that's the problem in terms of like the proclamation with the brutality against young black men. The response of people is that you keep changing it, like now you're putting it back on the victim. So you're saying that the real problem is the way black people are easily associating it with the white oppressor, which people who are against Christianity, yes, they're going to do that, right? Mm-hmm. But in reality, there is the issue of there's plenty of white Christians throughout the centuries, okay? Mm-hmm. America was considered a Christian nation, okay? Mm-hmm. And like she said, her idea of Christianity, my idea of Christianity, because I say the same thing, Christians have been in the forefront, you know, against oppression and everything. But the answer to that that they come back to is, yeah, okay, you had a few people. The Quakers were involved in the Underground Railroad and anti-slavery and whatnot. But the nation considered itself Christian, and you had white churches that would not, that were pro-slavery, mm-hmm. okay, and that helped, and that were, you know, they would not let black people in their church and whatnot like that. So they're saying if you take a populace of the whole country, the majority of them considered themselves Christian, but a lot of them were pro-slavery and very few were anti-slavery actively or even spoke against it. And that's what took so long to eradicate it, you know, in certain areas. That's so, you know, there's the argument on that end. A lot of what Christianity does is fighting injustice does go unnoticed on by the media.
True.
As, like, on the media, like he said, on those Christian stations, I don't even watch some of them anymore because, like, I remember the 700 Club. Everybody knows about that, right? Well, at the time when, you know, We Are the World, when the worldly musicians were trying to help free the South Africans, right, get rid of apartheid, Pat Robertson, he put up a big circle of all the things that we get from South Africa. And he said that really we should not try to help the South Africa get rid of apartheid because we would financially in America lose. It would create, everything would go up for us. We'll just send Bibles over there. That's what he said, right? So if I'm not a Christian already, right, if I'm not already a Christian, and then I see him saying that,
if I'm a Christian, I have a problem with that too.
Off, you know? That kind of thing. So then if I go to someone and I'm talking about Christianity, and again, if the oppressor, like that Ghanaian singer, she just wants to remind her people, don't drink the Kool-Aid. Have you forgotten? Okay. So if you have broken up my family, taken our land, or whatever like that, and you are the face that's telling me I should believe in Christianity, yeah, I'm going to be a little suspect, you know, like that. I can look past it if someone else is bringing it to me like that or whatever, or if I experience it for myself, which black Americans did. Mm-hmm. So that's why we embrace it.
Yeah.
If you experience it, like you're saying in Africa, when people experience for themselves, it's like Jesus said, if you lift me up, if they don't, they will come to me, right? But if you just are hearing it and you see that it's hard to get past the faith,
right?
You know, but in the 60s, it's hard to trust.
And I'm with you, I'm not saying that put the onus on the victim, that it's the victim's job to break down the door. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that we, as Christians, the community, the Christian community has to come together, unified, to try to break through that narrative that we see in the media.
Yeah.
We always see that constantly. It's always about the Christian, like you said, we want money.
Yeah.
But we're the community who knows that's not the truth. We're silent. We're not really putting that message together on the concert. Even an example with the movie Exodus. Mm-hmm. All I heard about the movie before it even came out was the issue with the cat.
Right.
And that was the whole issue with the movie. But I don't see us really pushing out there in War Room, a good movie, that have put out there, you see black faces casting in the movie, but we don't talk about it. And I'm like, that's our responsibility about that. Together.
As one community.
As one community.
Please.
Just a quick comment.
Oh, sorry. I don't know if I didn't really say anything about your question. I just realized that. But, you know, I'll stick with his answer. Okay, I just remember that.
Quick comment about early America. They wanted to condemn slavery in the Declaration of Independence, but three colonies said they wouldn't be part of it. Because of that, they didn't. Additionally, many colonies outlawed the importation of slaves, but the English Crown overrode those laws. So there was a strong movement, even before the Revolutionary War, opposing slavery in America. But my question is quite different. In Isaiah, it says, "I am the Lord God, I create evil." And my understanding is a good definition of the word evil is disaster. So we see a history of God bringing disaster down on Israel because Israel was wicked. And he used wicked people to do it. And then he blamed those people for murder. So now we see wicked people from Europe coming down on Africa and doing bad things. But if they hadn't, would these Africans still be pagans, often in warfare, mixed with cannibalism, etc.? Would they be impoverished? Would they be ignorant? According to all Christians who believe the Bible, going to hell still today. And are they better off having gone through the destruction brought to them by evil men in the name of Christianity today than they were in the 1500s?
Well, I think I don't think that we can say better off, right? Because, and then I think if we follow the strands of your argument, if I was arguing with you, I would take the side to say, so are you saying that God couldn't find any other way to, quote unquote, do that? Then, you know, then it's almost like you're saying by necessity for Africa to be where it is, and there's still lots of poverty, lots of problems. It's not like it's a perfect nation. There's still plenty of problems, right? But I think to try to predict where the nation would be without slavery, I think it's hard to do that. I don't think we can do that. But again, I don't think that we can say, you know, because again, I mean, if I was arguing with you, you know, I would then take lot, and then I would almost take the point to say, you know, are you blaming God for slavery? And are you absolving responsibility from the people who came and set up the systems? Right? So, like, but I don't think that's what you're saying, but if we were having a debate, that's where I would kind of push your question. So I think in answering the question, it's hard because I think it can easily get pushed in that direction, right? So, and then to try to predict where a nation would be without something that happened, I think it's hard to do, you know?
I just think we're not at liberty to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, when we read the stories in the Old Testament, we're getting a vision into what God's will is into a particular period of time because he revealed what his will was into a particular period of time. That doesn't therefore give us liberty to just sort of to say, well, because God used the Babylonians to judge Israel, therefore he must have used Europe to judge. I mean,
to judge them. I was saying that if Christians, missionaries had gone into Africa in the 1500s, before colonialism, the 1400s, would they have just been killed? Would they not have been able to reach? I mean, a lot of times when, according to history I've read, if a Westerner or European or went into parts of Africa, they were simply killed and eaten, and that was it. So would the Christian missionaries ever been able to penetrate Africa with the gospel without the disruption of the existing powers that wouldn't have accepted it, you know, the authorities and the traditions?
Yeah. Well, I think what happens is now it's almost like the problem is that the quote-unquote missionaries didn't just come with the gospel. They also came with their guns, and, you know, they came with their greed. They came with their exploitation. They came with their theft. And they also came and they killed. Right? So now to say that, oh man, these missionaries just came in here to save you, that's a lie. Right? And it's just, if they did, then, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, just one thing. I think we have no way of saying, if this had happened, that would have
happened. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We have not the faintest idea, given the possibilities before God. So I think that line of thought is really a destructive one.
Yeah,
we can imagine what could have happened if this had happened, what could have happened if something else had happened. Mm-hmm. We don't have a clue, and that's part of our humility before the providence of God and the sovereignty of God, is that we don't try and run that through, because it gets in terrible trouble, defensively, I think. So, I don't want to debate that.
We can talk
afterwards, maybe. Let's carry on with some other questions.
I just have to say, though, just a point is, one, all of Africa was not cannibals. And also that all the early missionaries that came were not all killed. Just correct something either too is it really wasn't the missionaries that were bringing all the guns and the greed and all that. That was big business, the same thing that goes on today. But to get the guns and stuff to back up their greedy plans, they said, let's go bring them for the missionaries. And what's John Wesley's brother's name?
Charles
Wesley. He came, some big conglomerate in America, and one of the southern states sent to the king and said, we really want a Christian leader. We need a pastor over here. He went, right? Now, they already were getting guards and stuff, but when he saw the greedy things that they were doing, and he preached against it, well, they locked him up, and they were trying to have him die before he could get back to England and tell it, So the Christian world has always been used as a map, as an excuse for the big business, interests to go into a country, it's like they're hiding behind the skirts of Christianity to build those roads, right? And to do what they want to do and to rape the country of its goods, and things like that. So I think it's not Christianity that did that, though the medieval wars, but we were the missionaries in the forefront, but right with them, behind them, was the big
Greek.
The mercenaries.
All right, there's like seven hands up. Seven of them. I'm going to pick someone that hasn't said anything.
I'm not.
So, sorry, go ahead. and then this young lady up here will be next, because I'll just go to the ones who haven't said anything. Okay, I'll go. You're next. You're bigger than me. go ahead. So also, Bradford, then you, and then my lady. Go ahead.
Thanks for this talk. It was really good to get the mind going and turning about issues like these. I think what it's kind of segue from the historical aspect to the current aspect that's going on today. I think it's interesting that the battle, or if we say on the Christian front, was kind of more a violent one back in the day, a more physical one that was felt and had a presence. And I think that made it identifiable to talk about institutions being relatively invisible. And I think now, as we've come along, we've made different laws, we've made moves in our country, we've made moves in many other countries to change those things, where behaviors now are regulated. But what I think the new front of oppression, not just racism, but oppression, a new front has been a mental and a heart battle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think and that one, we don't have the tools from a non-Christian perspective to battle. Because if you have a prejudice against me and you never do anything illegal, I can't stop you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say, I don't want you here, I'm going to shift things around to make sure you're never there, I've never done anything wrong. So I think on that front, we have to realize what, in terms of general oppression. Now, when we take that into racism now, I think that, over the years, we talked about a buildup of kind of the different perspective of not seeing anything and not wanting to be a part of it versus being a part of it. And I think I wanted to know some of your thoughts, and I'm going to relate it to the woman at the well, on how to battle that. You mentioned some earlier in terms of reconciliation. But when it comes to heart issues, I found it so interesting when I watched the methodology. I think Christ, I mean, we all do, but I just watching him, it's a genius the way he goes about affecting humanity. And he approaches this woman at the well. And one, he's approaching her as a Jew from a whole, you know, she even recognizes that, like, I'm a Samaritan, like, you're talking to me. And that point, I think, is one. I want to know if you agree with these points and what you see can be expounded on. But that point shows that I went from my community into your community to see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that needs to happen. Where now I'm understanding the heart issue and I'm understanding where that's going. One. Two, now I'm affecting you by actually, I've now entered your world and now through his method he used there through the Holy Spirit revealed what was going on in her life. I see you have this and husbands that aren't yours and wow, how do you know these things about me? You know, and I came into her life in such a way that was very impactful and now began to, he showed me, understood her plight, you know, of what she's going through with these different men not being satisfied. He's saying, I see you, but I can give you things that will change your entire world. You want water, you never thirst again for what I have to give you. You know, and when we realize that the gospel is that can quench the thirst of those who need it, I think when we are able to, from different nationalities and different areas and ethnic life, be able to enter in to those situations with the gospel, understand the plight, see what's going on, and then now make a move, we can actually, what I would think, is affect the heart, which is the new frontier of racism in this country is now, yes, there's police brutality, but if I don't feel comfortable around you, I feel scared around you, you know, how do I fix those things? Because I think there's some understanding that needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think that was great. Marty, go ahead. Marty, go ahead. No, we'll let Marty go by. I think you have something to say directly to that, right? I think so.
Because it's actually, a number of years ago, I read this book, More Than Equals, by a black man and a white man, Chris Price, Friends Are Perfect. And it was very much about what you're saying. You know, that, okay, lots of laws have been made. Things are better legally for black people in this country than they used to be. But how many white folks really have friends who are black folks? You know, that's what you're saying. How do you get to know each other? And I was really challenged by this book, particularly the way it pointed out that if you're white living in America, you don't need to know anything about black culture to get along fine. But if you're black living in America, you have to know a lot about white culture. Just with your mind, much less get along fine. And it was really a wake-up call for me, just maybe, because I'd always thought, you know, I'm not racist. But I don't really have any black friends. I don't know. They don't live where I live, and that was another thing.
Yeah,
you know, okay, in terms of the systematic thing. Why? And a lot of things came back to me. Actually, I remember a very painful story when I was in fifth grade. I lived on Long Island. I had a little black friend, Patty Gordon, who was in my class, and there weren't very many black kids, but we were good friends. And she came home to my house to play. And my parents belonged to a yacht club because they had a boat. It wasn't sort of a fancy yacht club, but they had a boat, and they had to get out to the boat on the launch. So they belonged to this yacht club. And I said, it was a great day to go to the beach. So I said to Patty, let's go to the beach. Let's go down to the yacht club. So that halfway there, she got a stomachache and went home. And I went home, and I told my mother, Patty had a stomachache. And she said, she didn't really have a stomachache. My mother knew black people weren't allowed at the yacht club. And I didn't know that. And my parents belonged to the yacht club, so they're both. But they knew this. But she frantically phoned and said, my daughter's coming down with her friend Patty, who's black. Don't anybody dare say anything to her. But of course, Patty's been told by her parents, don't have to try to go to the yacht club. So, I have no idea about this is the kind of, you know, systematic, I have no idea. And what about, you know, in schools and real estate and why there aren't any black people in where I live? Well, it has to do with the whole history and all sorts of things that I didn't know about. I wasn't responsible for, but in terms of what you're saying, what really challenged me with that book was, okay, racial reconciliation has to do with, has got to have to do with a white person like me who doesn't need to know anything about blood culture to get along fine, to actually make a move to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And which is actually why my husband and I started going to GSCC, which is why we go to a black church, and we have learned unbelievable amounts being there. Being minorities has been so helpful. Because it's nothing like being a minority to add in a place that doesn't cater to you.
Mm-hmm.
That you actually can start to see something, to, you know, the phrase is, love your neighbor as yourself. That means do the imaginative work to put yourself in the shoes of your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Jesus wants us to do. And that has been incredibly helpful to me, because of just going, being there, listening, making friends. And, who I never would have known before, who actually are, you know, live nearby.
Go ahead. I think you didn't talk to. Okay. That. Oh man. Everybody, take note of that.
Piggyback on something Marty said earlier, but they were talking about the thing that Lynn said about the Malcolm X movie. You're absolutely right. But when Malcolm X went to Mecca, he had a change of heart.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and he started embracing the help from the white, the Caucasian race. So I just have to put that out there. Yes, before he went, he was very militant, very hostile toward the Caucasian race. But then once he, as you said, once you go out and look at other people, other neighborhoods, other countries through their eyes now, it can change you. And it did that to Malcolm X. And I agree with Marty, and because of that, I'd like to think back to blowing up the ship, that they didn't blow up the ship, and I, in my eyes, they didn't blow it because they were willing to be disturbed. They were willing to be disturbed by going into our neighborhood, into where we are, and saw the injustices that was happening to us. And this is where media worked in our favor back in JFK's day, is that because of television, and now you could see how we were being treated in the cell and the brutality that was happening to us. You could witness firsthand the bombings. You could witness firsthand we being beaten with billy clubs and shot and dragged through the streets in the water hose. I'd like to believe it touched the Christian heart of our white people in charge. I would like to believe that the Constitution was changed by our forefathers because it touched their hearts when they were willing to be disturbed, when they were willing to go in and see, open their eyes and see what you are doing to, we didn't have to come here. We didn't volunteer to come here. We were drugged here, bought here, against our will, and what it did to us, that I would like to believe that their Christianity, whatever their Christianity was at that time, made those amendments to our law.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to believe we're not where we want to be, but thank God we're not where we used to be, that because Christianity spreading or touching the heart, no matter what religion you are of, that things have changed. Now they're shifting backwards, but I would like to believe Christians coming together will again affect positive change, and we will keep practicing what God said, love thy neighbor as thyself. And do unto others as you to you. I don't believe anyone in here wants to be beat and home and your house set on fire. So I'd like to believe that there is a subtle shift happening. These dialogues, I'd like to think that helps. And we will, Christianity will continue to rise and increase for the greater good of our world.
I like to leave that too.
Here, here.
And so, feedback from my point, I got the impression that we were somewhat, we didn't want to talk about violence. God works his will through imperfect men and women. So you're going to get some violence. Don't let that history of violence either turn you against it. I look at your title. My middle bit there from Christianity, the white man's religion towards the black man. I don't want it. He was my oppressor. Another way to look at that is that Christianity is the white man's religion. It's the white man's religion, and we're bringing it to you. Neither one of those is true. God's bringing something. Okay? So yeah, there's going to be some violence. Don't be afraid of it. But God, believe that God's will is being worked. And if you do, like I said, be a proclamation and you do your work, right thing will come.
And I just have to say, I'm sorry, I'm going to butt in here.
Keep going.
And to piggyback what Ron just said, Andrew Young said just before he died that evil and disevil has built in itself. We don't have to worry about it because evil has built into it destruction. Mm-hmm. So if you wait long enough, evil, the ills of the world, so whatever that is, it will soon destroy itself. And when I started thinking about that, I said, he's absolutely right. Look at slavery. You know, now we can still say we are still slaves in some areas, but I'm talking about, you know, 400, 600, 700 years ago of slavery. Look how that evil that was in there built in itself destruction. And it was abolished. And if we, you know, still, you know, fast forward today, the evil that's going on, look how it is destroying. Destruction is built into it. And then what Ron said, then God's power, his grace, his mercy rise up.
You had some great
Christianity, the white man's religion. I want to go back to that because I want to know, there are so many statistics on so many different things. Are there statistics on how black men, black people are falling away from the Christian faith? We were people who embraced the Christian faith. We were people who were blessed by the Christian faith. Are there statistics now that talk about how we are falling away from the Christian faith? The reason I'm very concerned about that is because we are being killed in the streets. And if we are falling away from the Christian faith, we are also being killed in the streets. And we are also being lost because we cannot embrace the very thing that can save us. If our sons or our daughters are killed in the street and they are Christians, okay, if they're killed in the streets and they're lost, that's where that significance comes in so greatly that we cannot allow anything to turn away our people from what is the very thing that is salvation for us.
Well, I think there's lots of stats on lots of things. I think one of if we're talking like just black men in general, Michelle Alexander, I'll say her book again, The New Jim Crow. It's kind of showing, you know, black men getting locked up and why from a systematic way. And I think one of the things that she points out that I think is so important is what happens to you when you are a felon. And what are your choices in the world? Right, so I think you know, there's massive opportunities on creating communities where they can be reentering and actually have somewhat of a life. And I think that, you know, just there's a massive number of African American men that is their plight. I think in younger generations, you also see, just because there's lots of stats that follow the ages of like 21 to 35 are the least likely to be in church. So no matter what race you are in the West, and I think, you know, if you look closely at those numbers, you'll also see, I guess, the trends there. So yeah, I think there's kind of, you know, stats tracking what's happening, and I think almost in a I think the a lot of times the numbers won't explain the whole story, right? So I always try to look at what's behind the numbers and kind of why we're seeing these things. But yeah, I think there's definitely statistics that are tracking that. And I guess you didn't ask this part, but in how we respond, I think there's we were talking about cultural apologetics earlier. Just if we can understand each other's worlds and then understand what are the lines of the gospel that are going to connect with you and your world, I think will be very helpful in, you know, trying to appropriate or take the gospel to different communities. So, please.
Oh.
You had something to say a while ago. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Listening to all the conversation, I really like what you had mentioned about the institution being invisible and something that we can't see. I took a class called Race and Ethnic Relations, and a lot of this falls into at a Christian university, and just having a lot of the same kind of state topics come up. One of the things that I keep coming back to that I'm struggling with is that making a proclamation. I've worked in an environment, I'm sure you have too, where even just making the proclamation, people don't even understand what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I said something last week that I never thought I would have to say, as we were discussing at my job, like dogfighting, and we were talking about that, like, oh, that's so wrong, blah, 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 and we should just save all the dogs, but, you know, those drug dealers, they could die. And I was like, here's the thing, a human life is still way more important than a dog. I didn't think I'd have to explain that to somebody, and I did. And she still didn't agree with me, which was really sad. So I'm struggling at the making a proclamation, because there's things that I have to make a proclamation about that I, like, why am I discussing this with you? This should be a baseline thing for humanity, but it's not. And so to even get someone to the point of understanding Christianity or white man, black man, the fact that a human life is more valuable than a dog's life is not a baseline thing, especially when it comes to what people see in the media, what people perceive as their surroundings. And I appreciate what you said about growing up, and I'm interracial. My mom basically grew up in the same kind of situation where bringing a black man home was not something you don't do, and she did. That was a problem. But all that to say, the fact that you said making a proclamation, it seems so easy, but it's just not. So what do you do with that when you're struggling to just basically find some humanity within the conversation?
Mm-hmm. It seems like I'm getting a lot of flack for that point. I'm going to proclaim that. okay, go ahead. You're good. I was going to respond. Are you going to respond there? Okay. I think that, you know, in making a proclamation, I guess I hope I didn't make it sound like just say something, right? Because a lot of times we can say things that are not helpful and that are not fitting. So I think to actually speak in a way that is helpful, I think it takes a lot of time on our part. So I think in making a proclamation, there has to be a lot of listening, right? Because so I think before, I think one of the ways that even Christianity would have spread a lot better in Africa is if I took the time to understand how you're viewing God instead of caricaturing it. And then almost like Paul in Acts 24, I can kind of look around at what's going on, and then I would know how to make a clearer proclamation so that I would be understood. But then I think that, you know, one thing about being patient, sometimes people like, how do you think that? But I think we have to be patient and know when to say what's fitting. I mean, I think words are, we have to use them, but they can be very dangerous. You know, so I think, you know, us listening and just learning when to say what is fitting. And
I almost feel like there's a step before making a proclamation. Like, I feel like there should be something before that.
What do you feel like it should be?
Listening.
Okay.
You just said it.
Yeah, yeah.
You awesome, didn't make awesome. A proclamation. Awesome. You said
baseline, human life is more valuable than animal lives, right?
Right?
So even though they were going to continue to disagree at the moment,
right,
you did take that stand, the Christian stand.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that was the proclamation.
Okay. I think that there are a lot of different kinds of oppression that's going on in this world and culture of false values that are really false values, but there's a lot of lies that our world believes, that our culture believes, a lot of it prompted by Satan. He deceives the world. There's a lot of oppression in our world and in this culture, the United States. And for instance, I believe the elderly, for instance, are... It really makes me very upset the way the elderly are treated, okay, and how they're devalued.
Mm-hmm.
And then you talk about abortion. There's an unborn child there, you know, that's totally defenseless. And I've had oppression in my life of my own kind. Everybody experiences oppression, especially the Christians, because Satan is trying to constantly oppress us. Okay, and what I find is if we have oppression in our lives, that we can become so self-focused because of that oppression that we can't see the oppression that other people are dealing with in their own individual lives or in their own age groups or whatever it is. And I'm not black, so I can't speak as a black person to express how it feels to be in that. You know, in that type of oppression, but I've certainly seen a lot of it, and that I also have received some of my own from, you know, being white in certain situations, you know, but not trying to compare those two. But I'm just wondering, do you think, and do you know if the black community of this country feels that the oppression that the blacks have gone through here is the worst kind of oppression, or do they see other types of oppression that are just as bad or worse?
I think it's hard for me to make a sweeping statement for all black people. So I can't speak on behalf of
black people that you know.
Yeah. I think it becomes hard to compare and weigh oppression versus oppression. I think it would be a hard question to answer, just because I think it's how do we weigh this versus this? Like what measuring system are we using to say this one is worse than that?
The focus,
you know,
has been within. Do you think from your exposure to the black community in America, do you think? I mean, I'm just curious to really know this.
Okay.
That they feel that this they're more oppressed than anybody else in our culture.
I put it here for
you.
Why are
you asking him what he thinks about it?
Yeah.
I'm asking both. I actually asked him.
Just like you know what you're exposed to. Those who are exposed to more will have one opinion of public water, and those who are exposed to less will have a very narrow opinion. Perhaps you just stereotype. Now you just stereotype. I grew up in Roxbury, and until I moved out of Roxbury, I knew a few white friends that I had in K through 3 who all disappeared by the time I hit middle school. Okay? So that's what I knew. And when I moved out of Roxbury, I got a wholly different, broader perspective. So everything that you've mentioned exists. The proportions, I don't know, and I don't think he knows either.
How can I compare my pain, when my pain is deep, really deep? I'll give you a perfect example. I have a girlfriend, one of my best friends, is dying of cancer.
mm-hmm. is dying of cancer. I have relatives, my mother died of cancer. There is no comparison. What my girlfriend is going through with her pain, that hurt, her suffering, I have no clue. And it's no comparison of my pain, the depth of my pain, the hole in my soul that still exists 17 years later of my mother passing from cancer. It's no different. I grew up black and poor. My father died when I was 7. My mother now had, we went from middle class to poor. She worked 3, sometimes 4 jobs to feed me and my brothers. And they were older. They were teenagers. They could work. She said, no way, Jose. She didn't have to work. She grew up with her dad was a college professor and a mason who had his own business, did extremely well. She grew up privileged. But when my father died, we were poor. Neighbors across the street were poor. We were poor. So when you talk about suffering, we had a pot of beans to share among 4 people and complain. The neighbors saying, white, as a matter of fact, how dare you complain about how awful your life is? I have nothing to feed my children. It's no comparison. It's like comparing apples to oranges, and you want me to see she has no food, no shoes. I'm starving. I'm hungry. I'm watching my mother not eat because she wants her children to eat, and I'm supposed to see that because you have nothing, you have less than that, I'm supposed to be sympathetic? It doesn't work like that. Maybe in somebody's eyes, maybe I should, but when I'm at the depth of my pain, my sorrow, my despair, no, I can't see yours. I can't see yours. I can't feel yours. I can't touch yours because I am at no hope. I'm at no hope. I see you possibly as hope. You see me possibly as hope. But when you have no hope at the depth of your despair, at that moment, no. He can't speak for me. He can't speak for me. My cousins can't speak for me. They're black. I have some are white. But they can't speak for me because what went on in their house is not going on in my house. It's not going on mine. So how can they speak for me? How can my cousin, big sister, looks white, passed for white? How can she speak for me? And we grew up a block from each other. How can she speak for me? She's black. She can't speak for me because she's not in a black world in her head.
But
she can't speak for me.
Either.
And I don't know her exactly. I don't know her pain trying to be something she's not. What I see is, how dare you? How dare you? But I don't know the depths of her pain and her struggles and her discrimination and abuse that was afflicted on her when it was found out. She's really so you can't do that. And I think it's unfair personally to ask people to speak for a whole race of people.
Yeah, it almost in a sense, I mean, no race is monolithic, okay? So not everybody's going to feel or have experienced the same things. But what I started to think about, and I think there's also sort of a generational piece here. Not too long ago, I went to see the movie Selma. And I look at what they went through in their attempts to march over that bridge and the fire hoses and the beatings and all these things that they experienced. And then I think about, there's a golf course, country club, down the street from where I live. And 20 years ago, I had a good friend of mine who was a VP for a bank, and he ended up joining, but he ended up joining over the phone. So when he showed up for their dinner, he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, this is for members only." And he said, "I'm your new member." So the level of, you know, that oppression or, you know, discrimination, but how does that compare to what folks went through, you know, in Selma? So I think it's all relative to what you personally experience. And nobody, as my wife was saying, nobody can feel the pain of someone else.
Well, I think we can, but we'll talk about
that.
All right, so I see everybody's hands, and I see you, but I passed over her. Like, I feel like I'm impressed with her, man. So.
We can do this as a friend, as opposed to, even though you have the isolation, something people, like, let's say, you, it's not a comparison of who's had the worst pain, there was this woman, older woman, she was Italian, but she had been a foster child in Boston, right? She, at 14, her and her friend were raped in a police car, in the back of a police car, because they had no power base, all right? So she very clearly understood, like, she didn't trust the police that easily, you know, either, right? So she could very easily understand, like, believe when someone else said how the police treated them. I myself, right, my son, when he started getting mistreated by the police,
did you say started one more time?
Started getting mistreated by the police.
You had such a Boston accent. I have
to be
I haven't heard it in so long, you know. I mean, so, oh, man, that's awesome.
Before that, I shouldn't even admit this, but I'm going to admit it, right, to make you feel better. You'll see. Is that I was like, well, I thought, like, black people in general, women and men, were, like, you know, oppressed the same, right? But until he became a teenager that became tall, now I feel so bad because I see how different the oppression is, how much hurt is hurled at him and young men that I didn't have to suffer because I was a woman and they didn't find me as threatening. If the police stop me, please, I have a much better chance because they're still living up female, you know, they just, they're going to be different with me. And I didn't know before that until I had a son and until he got to be a certain age to see what a huge difference it is. And that young man, the white man, from the young man from, I don't know, was it Princeton, that put the melanin in his skin, and he was going to do that experiment. Well, I have so much respect for him because he said he could only last, like, 3 days or 2 days. He expected to do it for, like, a whole semester, but just to, he didn't know how, just the way he was treated, he couldn't even take that. And that made me think, too, yeah, that every day of being looked at differently and looking at suspiciously or whatever, you know, it is walking a mile in someone's shoes, but sometimes your common thing, like a person that you know, felt a mistreatment, if you're open with me about it, then we might have more in common. You know what I'm saying? We can share. So now I'm going to believe you, you're going to believe me. But I have to say, being the mistreatment as a woman, and I said this one time to another feminist when I was in college, I said, I've always been treated worse because I'm black than as a woman. I mean, I've had mistreatment as a woman. I've been, you know, prepped for that. But the oppression for being black in America is much worse. So,
I think I'm you're next. I think the one thing that, you know, that the Bible says that God is going to wipe away every tear, right? So I think God knows our pain in an intimate way, and I think I'm stealing this from Dick. I steal a lot, and I don't give credit, but since he's here, I'll give him credit. I think it was one lecture I was listening to. He said, imagine how close you have to be to somebody to wipe away their tear, right? And that's, for me, the imagery was just powerful. We're talking about, you know, pain and suffering. I think it's hard to appropriate, but if we look kind of vertically, you know, God can be associated with our pain, and, you know, God knows our pain, each and every one individually, because God is personal. He knows everybody's personal story, and so God can, you know exactly what you need to heal you, and, you know, it says God's going to wipe away your tear because he's that close to you where he can get right in your face and take his hand and take your tear away.
Right? You know, there are so many times where I will be chosen first. But it is not as important, and I can't have as much to say. I mentioned Just one thing I would say is we are completely missing the point if we're trying to compare oppressions. The point is not...
That was not being understood, by the way.
Okay. All right. I'm not directing you at you.
Okay.
The point is not who is most oppressed or who goes through the most pain. Like, do you go through more pain for being a woman and being black, or do I go through more pain for being a woman? Like, who, why does that matter? What matters is that it's oppression, and that's what we should be fighting, and not the fact that we are that we are all in pain. We're all in pain. That is the point.
And I think because of that, the civil rights movement really took off. Because it wasn't just a black person's fight. White people suffered, got cold, got bit by dogs, killed, you know, fighting that pain, fighting oppression. And because of that, we came together and worked.
I couldn't see you back there. You're not that tall, sorry.
I was suggesting a few things. I think, to a degree, I'm partly thinking about the question you were bringing up, and I don't want to target you, but I was thinking, because people have different experiences in America, I'll say we're talking about the political context right now. The first word that came to my mind was triage, right? Mm-hmm. It's like there is always going to be oppression all around the world, pretty much all the time. Once we think we did pretty good in this area, somewhere else there is some foolishness and it's arising and we need to address that. So I think what happens, I guess, or what's happening on the world stage currently is just a matter of triage. What is the biggest, most horrible, glaringly obvious thing that needs to be addressed because it is rampant, or rampant, whatever the word is out there now, and it needs to be addressed because it's hideous. This is, I know extremes are huge, but I think they always exist to illustrate a point. The reason why the world came together after they started to see the horrible direction that Hitler's regime was going towards is because it said, okay, this is an immediate need. Act now and figure out what the consequences are. You know, let's figure out what to do to meet this need currently. And in medicine and in the medical field, it's understood. It's like, okay, maybe you have an issue, but this person is bleeding, shot in their wound, and we see the blood all over the floor. We need to address this a little bit more quickly than the fact that you've had a throbbing headache. You know what I mean? So even though they're both a kind of pain, and they are both serious, and they both need to be addressed, in the area of triage, it's like, this is so blatantly, it's a screaming emergency. And it makes me think also about the American. Dude is on the side of the road. He is very much in dire straits. Now, I could either keep on going by because I had a rough day too. You know what I mean? I see this is an emergent need that needs to be addressed immediately. And I need to act now, and although we are not kin, although we are not, you know, necessarily neighbors, in this instance, it's neighborly because you need me now. And you are close to me, and I have the ability to meet a need in a way that somebody who is, you know, 10 miles away, they don't understand your need. I'm immediately here. And I think that's a problem, and that's a challenge with people who are in America right now. And the reason why a lot of people are angry is because it's like, how do people in other countries see? They have these signs on social media, oh, Black Lives Matter, you know, those things. It's like, okay, but you're my neighbor. Can you see that this is happening? Do you see that this is a challenge? And although there are different areas of need for youth, it seems to be I am on the side of the road screaming, and you have not seen that, and you have not met that need. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to say that in providing a level of scope and perspective that makes it more palatable to people who would like to ascribe all lives matter. Yes, they do. So what is the emergent need currently? That there is a certain demographic, a certain group, that is, and they have an immediate need. And we can't say all houses are on fire. Matter, yes, but my house is on fire right now. So I don't want all of the fire, you know, firemen to go put water on every house. That's not gonna fix it for me right now. I don't, because by the time you get to my house, you know, I just felt the need to say the word. I maybe because triage is a very visual term that I think has enough context for people to get. You know, and I don't think that has been translated clearly with all of the different things that have been occurring. And I think that is a way for us to understand that no oppression, you know, can be measured. Like, you know, I think there's oppression of all kinds, but I think the reason why the people of color in this country who are, you know, darker hues, who are Black, African American, from any, you know, those kinds of descent, African American descent, or excuse me, African it's just that is the that's the emerging that is seeking to be expressed.
Awesome. Does someone has something else to say, not directed that way, like another? Okay, I'll let you three go, and then my man.
Mine was directed.
Go for it.
Well, it made me think. So initially, when the question was asked I think initially when the question was asked, the first thing I thought about initially, because what I heard was, is it possible while you're in your pain, can you empathize with other people? And I think, I think she was saying, you know, yes, you can. She started to mention that, and you can. But to your point, it is hard. When you're at the depth of more pain, it could be very hard for you to give that same attention to other people's pain, but I do believe you can still have empathy for another person.
Absolutely.
Right, and exactly. And I felt like the heart of the question was really just asking. I think it was stemmed almost from, Abby, your point of less self-righteousness. And I think it's because sometimes what we see in the media, or what I see in social media, is that you have these champions, right, that they're in really truly the depth of their pain. And it's hard for them to see anything else. And so it gives us almost like this arrogance and pride where, you know, do you not see anything else? And for me, you know, I do believe that there is, there's a serious issue right now in the Black culture. I think that there is oppression. And it is pain. It's real pain. But for me personally, I can't speak for every Black person, but I do also have that same empathy when I see sex trafficking, you know, and drug abuse. And, you know, also it's like my heart is maybe, you know, spread out because of the community that I live in or the people that I know, what have you. But I do believe it's possible to empathize with multiple causes. But I think the reason why the idea that people are just kind of tunnel vision when it comes to one particular cause is because of that self-righteousness that starts to come out. And then I think it is true. I think that sometimes we do get so stuck in, you know, well, this is my issue. You know, I don't want to hear anything else. I think that there's truth in that, but I also think it can get confusing because, to Carla's point, this is a serious issue. I get that he's bleeding, but this person's getting ready to die. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a dismount of everything, but it brought that to say that it's absolutely possible to empathize with other people that you may not be experiencing their pain. Absolutely possible. I think it's completely necessary. I think it will only happen when you actually are in it, when you become a part of a diverse community. Because it's almost impossible for me to empathize with someone that I don't know and don't know. It becomes challenging to do that. So I think it's possible. I think there was definitely truth to what she was saying. I think there needs to be less self-righteousness to really allow people to even come in. Because if you're so self-righteous about your issue, it's hard for me to even come in and, you know, want to, I want kind of to Tim's point with Malcolm X, you know, hey, what can I do to help? Nothing. You know, it's like, so I'm not really saying a real point, but those are my thoughts.
Go ahead.
Just goes with it very briefly. Just Paul's commandment to mourn with those who mourn and rejoice with those who rejoice. Mm-hmm. That means we are called. We are called, and by God's grace, we can't know someone else's pain the way we know it, but we are meant to be up there wiping your tears the way God does, which means really getting close and helping practically in every possible way.
Mm-hmm. I like that, because with my daughter, no, I don't know what she's going through. She has two children that she's going through leaving her. She has a son that she may not be here to receive his letter from the sector. I know that, all the oddities, definitely most, but I can't possibly know what she's doing.
And you can mourn with her.
I can mourn with her. I can cry with her. That I can do. But to feel that, no. And that level of despair when the doctors have said there is no hope, and she's trying to hold on to hope, I can't mourn with her. Yeah.
I think this, we asked her what that proclamation sounds like, and I think that proclamation has to sound like John 13:35, where it says, by this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. And I think, our words are powerful, and then they move people, but our actions, I think was mentioned earlier, need to be forefront. And I think to the example of the pain of, I'm an honored by Christ. but like his example of suffering and response is absolutely amazing. There's the brilliant side of God that we talked about earlier. Now let's talk about the empathy and just the understanding that I'm with you. So he's on the cross and he's being crucified. And he's in pain. And he's in suffering. Indescribable pain. But what does he say? Forgive them. For they know not what they do. It's almost as if I see that they're in oppression. Because they're not seeing who I am and what I came to do. But I'm going to reach to them in my suffering when I'm on the cross before I give my last breath. And I think if my favorite Bible verse is the one that says to attain to the perfection of Christ in Matthew, because we as human beings are made innately to want to achieve, or made innately to want to discover and do new things, but to discover the perfection of Christ is the ultimate. To see that become us, where in our suffering I can reach across and say, listen, I'm here with you, because I can actually see and feel. I'm suffering, so I know you're suffering. It's boring because like, oh my goodness, I have to respond that way. But then it's also like encouraging because like I can respond that way because I'm empowered by him.
First of all, this is really great. I mean, awesome reconciliation for me personally. Coming from the South. I've been thinking about this a lot for the past year, I guess. I have a lot of friends that are involved in the Black Lives Matter movement back in North Carolina, and a few of my friends are black in that movement, and one is a culturally practicing Muslim in that movement as well. And I'm really interested in the idea of hospitality ministry and working in neighborhoods of the marginalized as a Christian, spreading the gospel. For me, I see that happening in a rural area, I guess specifically where I'm from, which is predominantly white and rural, but I have friends that are wanting to work in neighborhoods of the marginalized, the people of color, and people, of different cultures and different backgrounds. These are white people going into neighborhoods to be leaders, bringing in the gospel, and I see what they're trying to do, and I think it's a good thing, but at the same time, I have this struggle to where I see white people entering a black space, or a Hispanic space, and maybe taking over, almost, and leading it, and not knowing that they're contributing to the gentrification of that neighborhood, they're contributing to maybe kind of pushing that culture out ultimately in the long run, and not thinking in terms of letting the leadership come from the margins and letting the people that are most marginalized by the system be leading its redemption. And that's just something, I don't know, as a Christian, because I could see myself wanting to do that, and a part of me does want to do that. But my friends in the Black Lives Matter movement discourage me from doing that. And it's not that I don't think this is good news that needs to be shared at all costs, because I do. I think Jesus is very important to share, and, you know, whatever the cost. But how do we incorporate respecting the oppressed and giving them validation and giving them leadership in places where, you know, we are known to take over and do things that are not, I think, for the people and for the culture?
I think that's an excellent question. And I forgot where I read this, but that the police force was started because of Irish immigrants, but they came to the country, and we had to start a police force because they were, you know, out of control, pretty much. But the police force, by and large, were, you know, Irish people, right? So it was almost like an Irish problem. So the police were Irish, the lawyers were Irish, you know, so like everyone, so it was almost like the Irish fixed their problem almost within their community. Right, so I think, you know, we have an example of that almost where the history of where the police force actually was started from. So I think that there is credence in that. But I wouldn't necessarily wholesale negate, you know, communities working together. And I love when you said hospitality, because I think that's a real way that it can happen, is when we, you know, almost create space for each other. But I think the problem becomes when, you know, if you don't listen enough and actually know what the problems are and you think you have a solution just because, you know, you learned it, you know, in your business school or whatever school you went to and you read it in a book, and then you come and try to, like, without actually listening and educating yourself on what's going on, and then you try to dictate and mandate, this is the way we're going to do it now, I think a lot of times that's just not, you know, helpful, right? So I think there has to be a level of listening. There has to be a level of, you know, humility and honesty, and that I think there is going to be struggle and tension, but I think we can learn to work together as we kind of make room for one another, almost in a sense. Right? I think. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't know.
It really is. But yeah.
No, just very quickly. I was going to kind of speak to your point, Ava, and weirdly, I didn't want to, but feel like moved it. Don't very much want to connect to, like, words. But a political example, but then also like an example. I lost my words. I guess what I was saying about is really important. And I personally believe, I can't speak for everyone because I know a lot of people come from different experiences, their experiences different from my own, that would disagree with me. But that listening is really important, and that leadership that comes from that space. If you're coming in from outside, then you're coming in to be from outside. And you may have a lot to offer, but you also recognize what the table looks like. I mean, I think about this in all things of diversity is, you know, if you are asking other people to come in, when that happens, the table changes. The conversation changes. The experiences of our collective group change. And if you're going into that, you're also changing that, obviously. I think going in with a lot of listening and humility and allowing for growth to happen organically is enormous. And we try so much as people to make the change, to shift it out of our own kind of acts and words. What I was confused about a moment ago I look at democracy and how where it has grown organically, it's worked much better than where people have tried to transplant an idea.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm thinking about that, I'm like, why would I bring that up here, is it connects to what you were speaking in your talk, Abba, about when you were mentioning groups that use their same word for God when they come to Christianity. When you're finding an understanding that meets your experience, you're able to shift and change and grow with that understanding rather than a transplant. And I think that's very important. I think a lot of people can't always recognize in themselves that what they are doing is transplanting. I have trouble doing that as a teacher. Where I'm like, oh, your experience is 7 of the years. That is rude of me to assume that we're having a certain conversation we're not having. And I need to know what the conversation we're having. And I think that you seem to understand that very clearly. But talking with your friends about that, what does it feel like to come into that space of that humility and seeking organic growth that may look nothing like what one expects? And a person might be in it for a long haul, which is a choice that someone has to make.
Right.
Go ahead, Sherry.
Oh, I was just going to say, you started to mention almost a gentrification almost. I think in your, and I felt like what your mission is in gentrification, two separate things. Because you were saying that sometimes you got pushback from some people. So I think that's their idea, that you bring in all these people and they change the landscape. I think that's a lot different, because oftentimes what I've seen, like in Atlanta and other major cities, they just pretty much uplift this whole community from here and then redo everything, which is completely different than you wanting to come in and again living intentionally in a community that may not look like you, in humility and wanting to listen and be patient and in it for the long haul. You know, I think it's hard when you ask people, because everyone's going to have this kind of this thought like of what your intentions look like. But I think if you know truly what your intentions are and you understand that it is about humility, it is about being patient and listening, and with that intention, and I can't speak for everybody, but I don't see anything wrong with it. In Hartford, I live in a house, and we had predominantly black neighborhood. We had a couple white, my landlord was white, and they intentionally lived in this area, and they intentionally did this area, and I can't say that anyone was ever like, oh my God, they loved them. You know, but they were there, they're there, and they are there for the long haul. And I never saw a problem with it. At all, because it's not like they were coming in saying, this is how we're going to make this, you know, do this street's going to look like this. They actually rebuilt a house, and my friend Aaron, which I wish he was here because you were mentioning it, and I was like, oh, Aaron would be a perfect person to ask. Because they rebuilt, you know, they were rebuilding houses, and now she's living there. She's still a minority. But the idea is just, it is to make life better slowly, but I just don't think they came in and was kind of like, oh, I'm going to just do this. So I don't mean to, like, push you one way or the other, but I just want you to not just take like one group, because sometimes there's just, they may have heard a different thing than what you actually wanted to do and took it like you're like going to go in and just change the place. And it seems like even just from hearing your ideas, it was coming from honestly a place of wanting to do something, just not maybe not knowing how to do it, but I don't need to be discouraged just because somebody's like, hey, that's a bad idea. Again, I don't know what that is.
No, I think it's like you've already said. Go and you make a relationship with someone there. I mean, Paul didn't stay and become the only pastor of the church. He raised up one or two who took over leadership, and then he went somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, not a byproduct. It means you're going to have to invest in somebody. Mm-hmm. You may invest well, you may not. Not all Paul's churches ended up the same. If you look at Revelation, a bunch of letters went out, and they're all different places. But the what God needed to have happened happened.
I think also none of us ever like being treated like cons. And like it's a very different, I have a very different response when someone approaches me with an attitude of it's clear that they think they need to fix me, as opposed to what's going on with you, how can I help?
love. And it's just, I think that's common to people, is that we are people. So you are also a person, so please don't treat me like you are more equipped as a person to do personhood than I am. So I really love what you guys have to say about humility, because
Ben's giving a lecture about that soon. Come back. Shameless plug. The first one was good. No pressure.
Because having humility takes denying yourself. It takes denying your right to yourself. In terms of, like, we're not naturally prone to loving other people like ourselves. I don't think. And because humanity is broken. So I think in a lot of ways, like what Bradford was saying earlier about in terms of racial conflict being the battleground, being the heart and the mind, is that now we no longer have the defense of our own personal selves of, well, it's the law and I can't do anything about it. Now it still exists. So that means something might be wrong with me. And none of us really like to see that about ourselves. And so it is important as followers of Christ that we look at the fact that we are broken people. Like, not just that there are broken people in America that are ruining things, stop it. You know, but yes, but that we are part of that equation, you know? And I think that that helps a lot in terms of changing our own mindsets about the way we approach people. And like, I am a member of a very small church that runs a very small school, and we have had people come in, and my dad is the pastor, and we have had individuals just kind of approach us and be like, hey, I'm here to give you all these great ideas about how you can do your ministry better and how you can do it more effectively, and here's how I'm going to do it, and this is how I'm going to fix what you guys are doing wrong. And it didn't help. And it doesn't help when we approach it that way. And so I think that that's a big underlying thing, is seeing how you can build up and help, rather than, I see your problem, so I'm going to fix it for you. Because, I don't know, I think that's a natural tendency that we have. I'm a teacher, so like that's something I have to work on with my students. Like, I see what your problem is, let me just fix it, and then we don't have to deal with it. But they don't learn when I approach it that way. And in that situation, I am in a position of greater understanding and authority. But that's not the case across the board in terms of humanity. And I think as a white person, I think that white people in our country have a history of approaching other cultures as though white people can help fix what's wrong with you. And it's not the case. So I don't know, I just think that.
It reminds me of a quote from a woman I used to work for, who managed a garden I worked at, and it went something like, when we work with the poor and hungry, only then do we realize we are the ones that are actually poor and hungry. You know, I mean, that's really, this is it. So if I'm trying to feed people, I realize I am just as spiritually hungry as they are physically hungry. And I can learn from them, and I'm the one that's really hungry.
Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank you. Boston. Yeah. Thank you.
Maybe would you just lead us in prayer?
Oh, absolutely.
And, you've covered a lot of ground. I kind of expect you to, with one prayer, hold it all together.
Cool. Thank you, God, for this time. Thank you for being sovereign over our lives. Thank you for knowing who we are, knowing what we need. And thank you for caring for the world, and thank you that you are in charge of sending your word forth. Oh God, thank you for what you've accomplished tonight. We pray, oh God, that you would deal with us where we need to be dealt with, and help us to be better ambassadors of your truth. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Thanks very much. Thank you, Ellen.
Good job. You dealt with it really well.
You're not going to run off.
I wanted to meet all my. Okay, I'll be back in
there.
I mean, it's